That's me like half the time.
Hi, everybody. We're live. Yeah, I'm coming in hot. I forgot to join the chat room.
Someone just emailed and said, oh, they've missed the show again this week. I said, no, you haven't missed it.
You're literally about to get... Oh, I forgot to tweet, post, fart. What's the... Oh, God.
Who knows?
Toot about... There we go. I forgot to do that. Maybe that's why they missed it. Oh, no. All right, I'll get there. Hold on. We're live now. Okay. There. Sorry, everybody, for the lack of notice, I guess. I mean, almost 200 people have figured it out already, so I think we're all right.
I saw Toots go that were announcing that it would be today, so it was announced.
Yeah, but not like, you know, not my usual countdown. But anyway, right. I just barely made it here. I had to rush pair all the socks in the laundry before I came in here.
I thought you were going to say you had to, like, rush home from Manhattan. Oh. You know, you're living the fancy lad life or something like that. Nope. Matching socks.
On the bed was a whole bunch of unsorted socks. And, you know, usually, as I've discussed on the show, my roles in the household are kitchen, dog, wires, and puke. And Tiff is soft things, plants, school, and fun. Now, soft things would typically be her purview, so she does all the laundry. However, there are occasional exceptions that poke holes in those boundaries, because one person really hates something or doesn't mind something. And one of the things is that Tiff does all the laundry but really hates pairing socks. So that is my job. And so I wanted to hurry up.
You can't
do
that in a hurry, though. If you do it in a hurry, you're not going to match them up right.
You underestimate my skill, John.
No, I think you underestimate the amount of stuff I think is involved in matching socks.
I think you both underestimate the sneaky, sir. And that's a reference that I bet John didn't even get.
No,
what
I
now?
Didn't.
What now? All right, we'll see if ATP References gets it.
Yeah, no. I mean, so the thing about matching socks is it's not so much just finding the sock that is the same sock as that one. You have to, they go in pairs in terms of wear and age, you know what I mean? And right and left. So you really want to, you want to pair the ones that have always been together to be back together. Even if you have, you know, 16 of the same socks that came in a pack when you bought them all, you can't just match them up willy-nilly with their other socks when they come out. They have to go back with their partner.
See, I solve this in a different way. So I, two things that have radically...
You only buy two of a sock ever.
Yeah, well, so that's, okay, yeah. So one of them, yes, one of them is my favorite socks are from former sponsor Marine Layer. And they're one of those things where, like, you know, they'll have like five pairs of socks in stock at any given time. And they just rotate out all the time. So you kind of have to buy them if you see them, if you like them. And so as a result, I have all sorts of different socks from Marine Layer, and I try never to buy two of the same pair. So I actually don't have two identical sets of the same socks, except for the summer short socks, which is just like some big Adidas bulk pack of ankle socks I bought. And so far, those are just so interchangeable that it doesn't really matter. They're just all a bunch of gray socks.
That's what I'm saying. You're not as discerning. You're like, you've seen one Adidas athletic sock. You've seen them all. They can go with any of them. But no, there are pairs.
There aren't. Not for those. But the other thing is, what really dramatically shrinks the time for any kind of, you know, laundry folding, especially with socks, is I used to do the service to my family of turning them all the right way as part of this process. And
is that a service? That's just called folding laundry. Are you putting socks in your drawer inside out?
Well, if you ball the socks up, it kind of doesn't matter whether they're inside out or not. And so I've decided that... So when I remove my clothing, not to get TMI listeners, but when I remove my clothing, I leave it in the laundry, the right side in or out or whatever. So
yeah,
my
so
laundry does not
everybody.
Have to be turned back, because I'm conscientious on the way into the machine. So I save, so all my laundry comes out, for the most part, the right way. So my socks are all the right way. And the rest of my family's socks, I just fold them exactly the way they left them.
That's spiteful. And B, if you put them into the washing machine inside out and they have crap on them, the crap is going to stay stuck inside the socks. Like if you get a bunch of like little, you know, little bits of leaf or wood chips or whatever stuck to the bottom of your sock and you take it off inside out and it goes in the washing machine, that stuff's not coming out. It's going to be right in there when you turn it the other way. So you're not even getting your stuff clean.
My stuff goes in the correct
way.
Well,
that's, yeah.
My stuff
Everyone
gets
should
clean.
Turn their clothes right side out before they put them in the hamper.
I agree, but not everyone does.
Well, see, one of the services you could provide by doing laundry is turn them right side out before you put them in the washing machine.
Yes, that's what, when I take my own clothes off and put them in the laundry, that's what I do. But the rest of my family, hey, they can do what they want to do. They're people. It's America, man.
All right. All right.
This is a tremendous point of contention in the List family, because I generally do a very good job of turning my clothes, you know, the proper way out and right side out or whatever. But for whatever reason, I, to many people's dismay, especially Europeans, I prefer to have an undershirt on when I wear anything, really. So I'll have, you know, some sort of white t-shirt or whatever. And then I'll put on whatever shirt goes above it, even if it's another t-shirt. And for whatever reason, when I take off that undershirt, I often don't realize that it's inside out. I don't know what my problem is, but it happens often enough that Erin is justifiably driven bananas by this. She typically does the laundry. Occasionally I will, but she typically does it. And it drives her absolutely nuts. And she has gotten to the point that she has said, look, I am not going to fold the ones that are inside out because I'm sick of it. And honestly, she's right in saying it, because it happens way more than it should. I don't know what my deal is. I need some sort of like alarm.
You change your shirt removal technique.
Apparently.
If you peel it up from the bottom, it ends up inside out. But if you pull it up by the neck hole.
I usually pull up by the neck hole. That's a title. But I don't know what happens with the undershirts.
At least it's not like socks, though. But A, there shouldn't be lots of sticks and twigs and stuff all over it. And B, it's big enough that even if it is inside out, I still feel like it'll get clean. But C, yeah, figure out how to take your shirt off without turning inside out if you can't remember to do so.
I mean, right. She could also try a more aggressive penalty. Like, maybe anything that you, any of these shirts that you put inside out in the laundry, she just throws them away.
Yeah. Textile recycling. Right.
Like one of our soft things policies, which I did not invent, nor do I participate in, but I'm the victim of it, is if I am wearing a pair of socks, and there is a small hole in the toe or whatever,
it's garbage time.
In order to ensure that those socks go in the garbage, if Tiff finds one of these holes on the sock that I am wearing, she will tear it wide open to be a much bigger hole, so my entire foot falls through it. So that ensures, like, okay, now this sock is really ruined, so you definitely will not wear it again. I mean, look, and as a result, I don't wear holy socks for very long. So, you know, more severe penalties can be imposed, Casey, if you want to change your habits. Like,
yeah, seriously.
I mean, it's not very, you know, efficient or productive, but it will get the job done.
I hear you. Yeah, I will have to recommend that to her, even though I don't want to, but I need to. All right, let's do some follow-up. I know everyone is waiting with bated breath to know how football went this past Sunday. The Giants lost, as they always do, but I'm happy to report that the system worked, and I was able to watch a game on Fox that was not in my local area, and it was pretty much flawless, and I'm very happy about that. So I know the two of you, especially Marco, the newfound football fan, were deeply concerned, and I'm happy to, you know, put your mind at rest. All worked according to plan.
And to be clear, this is the VPN method, or is this some kind of weird cable home run?
This is a combination of actually today's sponsor, Tailscale. It legitimately is using that. This isn't a clever plug for a sponsor. It really, truly is a legitimate, honest-to-goodness thing. But it's Tailscale, the Channels app, and TV Everywhere. A combination of those three things basically got me where I needed to be. So happy to report it did work. Now, moving on, it is holiday season, and so we are going to talk more about Festivitas, which is Simon Stavrings, I think, hopefully, holiday light app. And one of us, I think it was John, I'm not 100% sure, probably John, was wondering, how does Simon figure out how to hang the lights on the dock? And I'm sorry, I should back up a half step. This is a thing, it's just for fun, and it's really cute, where you can put holiday lights on like your menu bar and your dock and whatnot. And John, I believe it was you wondering about how Simon figured out where to hang the lights, especially during like magnification and stuff. And I understand that you have answers for us.
Yep. Simon wrote in to say Festivitas.
Yeah. Festivitas, I think.
Festivitas. Okay. Anyway, his app is not using a private API. It's using the accessibility API to read the frames of every tile in the dock. And based on those frames, create a CG path. This requires sandboxing to be disabled, so the Mac App Store is still a no-go. So this is one of the other unfortunate situations that I've talked about on the Mac before, where there is an API to do something. It's a public API, but it's old. Apple has deprecated it, and if you want to submit your app to the Mac App Store, you can't use this API. And believe it or not, the accessibility APIs on macOS fall into that category. So no, they're not private, as in, you know, you're not supposed to use them, period, although you could. But no, this is a public API, but Apple says, yeah, you can't be on the Mac App Store if you use the accessibility APIs. And it's basically because they're old and they're, like, their permission level is not granular enough. I mean, they're old and creaky APIs to begin with, so you don't really want to use them, but they do what you need them to do. But they're too powerful, essentially. Like, if you get accessibility permission for your app in the Mac App Store, you could do all sorts of nefarious things, and Apple just says flat out, okay, well, unless you have one of these super secret private exceptions, quote-unquote temporary exceptions, you can't do that. And I understand all of that, except I feel like, okay, but how many years into Mac OS X or whatever you want to call it do we need to be before a modernized version of the accessibility API comes along that you can use and ship in the Mac App Store? So anyway, there you go. Not it technically a private API, but still something that keeps the app out of the Mac App Store. It's the sad story on the Mac continues.
Truer words never spoken. So I have not tried this yet, but a handful of people have written in with regard to my forthcoming adventure in trying to figure out when my washing machine has finished washing. And a lot of people said, oh, you should use, you know, a power outlet thing that'll read how much power the machines are using. And that's reasonable, although for personal reasons, like, I don't love the idea of a big, you know, appliance going through one of these little dinguses in the wall. And so I was thinking about using a vibration sensor to figure out when the washing machine or the dryer has completed. And a few people wrote in to say, you know, another thing you can do potentially is use an accessibility feature called recognize sounds using iPhone. And what this does is your iPhone can continually listen for certain sounds, such as a doorbell siren, a crying baby, and notify you when it recognizes these sounds. And there's a knowledge base article that we will put in the show notes. This all sounds well and good, and it very well may work. I had intended to try it before recording, and I apologize. I just didn't have the chance. But the real crux of the issue is that our laundry room is actually upstairs, which sounds kooky at first, but is really convenient because most of your laundry is generated, so to speak, or put in the hamper anyway, upstairs.
Oh, yeah. That's the way to go if you can.
Yeah, exactly. So it's one of those things where at first, when we were looking at the house many, many years ago, we were like, what? And then once we had it, we were like, oh, this is excellent. This or a laundry chute. Laundry chutes are the best. But anyways, so the problem is often that the little sireny doodad, if it isn't set loud enough, which is a user error, or if we're just downstairs on the other side of the house, again, as I've said many times, our house is not that big, but it's big enough and there's enough activity, especially with small kids, that oftentimes we just can't hear it. And I'm skeptical that my phone would be able to hear it, but I am definitely going to give this a shot and see what happens. But we'll see. All right. We have some interesting feedback from Ricky Haas. Ricky writes, well, it's true that the Apple Store only sells SSD modules for the Mac Pro. Apple also has a first-party parts store, the self-service repair store for Apple products, which somehow is the domain selfservicerepair.com.
Yeah, I don't know how Apple would be in there somewhere. We talked about this when they first rolled this out, and we were talking about the giant expensive set of tools that you get that you have to return and everything. But yeah, this is that same thing. It still exists. They continue to expand it.
No, yeah, I mean, I think that was intentional. Like, when Apple launched this, they did so extremely quietly and kind of like holding their arm out all the way, like at arm's length, like, here, you guys just like take this. Like, they really, I don't think they want a ton of people to know about this, and they certainly don't want their brand associated with it.
Yeah, so it's very weird. It's worth you loading the web page website just to see how not Apple-y it is.
Yeah.
But either way, I put this, hello, future Marco. Totally put this in the wrong spot in the show notes, and I set myself off. I got to jump down and then jump back up. And John, I'm surprised you didn't say anything. So hold on. Let me just put this in the right spot.
I thought you were going to talk about it right now.
No, I think it makes more sense to wait smidge and get, let's see, right at the, hold on. I know this is, I'm vamping. I'm sorry. Okay, there we go. Hello and goodbye, future Marco.
Bye.
So Ricky writes, it typically takes some time after a product launch for parts to show up, so they don't have components for the new Mac Minis yet. However, if they sell the same components as those available for the Mac Studio, they should eventually offer storage upgrades. Unfortunately, Apple doesn't allow you to simply browse all available parts. You need to enter a serial number. And so I saw this and I immediately said, okay, well, I've got a serial number for my MacBook Pro. This is a year ago MacBook Pro. It's a M3 Max MacBook Pro. And so I entered my serial number and I was, you know, just goofing off looking at different options. And for my MacBook Pro, it would appear that the SSD is soldered into the logic board or is certainly not considered a separately removable and serviceable part. And so I looked, okay, well, how much is a logic board for my MacBook Pro? A logic board for my MacBook Pro, they bill you $4,751.12. This is 64 gigs and 8 terabytes. $4,700.
Now, wait, hold on. You did just gloss over those two numbers
the
pretty quickly.
Part.
Well, yeah. It's fair, but still, I mean, the whole machine I think was like $5,500.
Well, that 8 terabytes thing is made of tiny diamonds. I'm not sure.
Apparently,
if you know this,
but... apparently, but in the defense of Apple, I then continued reading down a little bit, and it says replaced part return credit is $4,312. So actually, according to Apple, if I understand this right, the price is, and they list it right there, price after credit, $439.12, which for 8 terabytes and 64 gigs and an M3 Max, that's actually not that bad. But ooh, baby, you got to shell out $5,000 to get there, and then they'll eventually give you a whole pile back.
Not to mention the process of replacing it would probably not be
right, exactly. Yeah.
I wonder if you could get a cheap 8 terabyte NAND that way. Like, if something goes wrong on your logic, because you don't. Does it say that you have to have like a broken one? You know what I mean? I guess you don't know.
You have to return the board back. Like, yeah, I don't know how you would. I mean, you probably shouldn't be defrauding their repair system by stealing the NAND off the motherboard somehow. Like, that's, right.
You'd return your intact one, but you'd get a fresh one. Like, you could basically get a fresh logic board.
I see what you mean.
You know what I mean? Like, just because it's so cheap. I mean, obviously, you don't pay for your own labor, and probably you're screwing up your computer every time you open it up and close it back up. But that's what you get for having a laptop.
Right. So anyway, so I went on a little side quest there. Let me get back to what Ricky was writing. So Ricky writes, and let me repeat, unfortunately, Apple doesn't allow you to simply browse all available parts and need to enter a serial number. So Ricky continues, I managed to find one from a Mac Studio via a YouTube unboxing video, which makes me so happy. But anyway, and voila, NAND modules are available directly from Apple. And so Ricky was kind enough to send some screenshots, and various different modules are available, 5, 12 gigs, 1, 2, 4, and 8 terabytes. The cheapest at 512 gigs is $395.12, and then you get $44 back if you replace the return part, so that means the sum total is $351.12 for 512 gigs. On the flip side, 8 terabytes, like yours truly, $2,464. Then you get a measly $369.60 back. So your price after credit for an 8 terabyte unit for Mac Studio, $2,094.40.
Yep, this is a profit center. I mean, look, this is like when you buy parts for an expensive car from the manufacturer. Like if you're gonna have like some kind of like high end sports car, if you want to go to the manufacturer to buy their brake pads, they're gonna cost a heck of a lot more than everyone else's brake pads. But that's kind of their privilege, and some of it is like, well, we have very high specs for our brake pads, but a lot of it is just their profit, right? That's the business model, and that's what this is too.
And actually, in the realm of expensive cars, the parts, when you buy them aftermarket from the manufacturer, like the original, actual, genuine parts, cost way more than you can possibly imagine. Like, if you add up the price of all the parts that you would have to buy to build the car that you just bought, it would cost just many, many times more. Whereas these prices are merely pretty much exactly the same as the insane prices that Apple charges when you buy the Mac. You know what I mean? Like, I think the prices are very close. Like, maybe they're actually a little bit cheaper, but as we saw before with the Bugatti headlights, it just doesn't make any sense if you look at the prices. And it's because, especially with very fancy, expensive cars, they don't want to keep a lot of parts in stock. And the few that they do keep in stock, to make it worth their while to keep any in stock, they charge huge amounts of money for one little piece of plastic, forget about like panels and body panels in the car, just any little thing in the car. There's like 7 of these in the world, and if you want one, you have to pay a huge amount of money. So be glad Apple merely charges normal Apple prices for its parts.
Indeed. All right. More from our friend of the show, Jonathan Dietz Jr., with regard to SSD performance. Here again, there's a lot here, and I'm going to read pretty much all of it. So bear with me, but it's really fascinating. So Jonathan writes, the state of SSD benchmarking on the Mac is pretty sad. Nobody should be making buying decisions or even be particularly concerned about the sequential read and write speeds of Mac SSDs.
Let me pause there for a second, mm-hmm. because... thank you, Jonathan, for saying what I always try to say whenever we talk about benchmarks and what used to be one of the main activities that I participated in online, which was technical people complaining about how benchmarks are not representative. We'd argue about Mac versus PC and CPU benchmarks and AltaVec versus MMX, right? And it was all about like, well, byte marks versus spec int versus this. And it was people arguing that benchmark is not a good one. It can be gamed. It can be cheated. It's not representative of real performance. Or, okay, well, I'm playing a game. I get better frame rates than this. Well, that it has a good port on this platform, but a bad port on that platform. So that's not good a benchmark either. All we did was argue about how benchmarks didn't mean anything. And now, in the modern age, go to any YouTube video, listen to any podcast, and you're just like, oh, well, this is what Geekbench says, and this is what the benchmarks say. And nobody argues about it anymore. They're just like, yeah, the benchmark says this is faster, so I guess it must be faster. There's so much to be argued about these benchmarks, especially with things like Geekbench, which we really don't have. I mean, you have some knowledge of it, and you can get kind of into technical detail, but it's nothing like the open source spec benchmarks were back in the day, or like, you know, running games that are open source that you can compile for any platform, and then it becomes like a compiler benchmark. So kudos to Jonathan for doing what was once a great pastime and has now fallen by the wayside, which is complaining about benchmarks. They're no good.
Gracious. The results of the two most popular benchmarking tools, Blackmagic Disk Speed Test and AJA, are akin to comparing quarter mile times for a car. Amorphous disk mark is better, but still miles from the type of in-depth testing that Anontech, rest in peace, used to conduct. All of them appear to report optimistic write speeds, probably due to the effects of write caching by the system. Perhaps the biggest problem with these numbers, though, is the inability to identify the actual hardware being tested. Knowing the specific Mac model and disk size being tested is the bare minimum for making these results comparable. Ideally, you'd also want the IOREG entry for the controller characteristics property of the Apple ANS3 NVMe controller or Apple ANS3 CGV2 controller object. Man, I don't really miss Objective-C naming. That is not something I miss in my life. Anyway, the property provides many details about the underlying architecture of the SSD. In particular, the dies per bus key reveals the total number of NAND dies in channels, from which we can infer the number of NAND packages, and the NAND marketing name key tells us the type of NAND used, number of planes, and density. All you have to do is pop open the terminal and run the following command, no teardown necessary. For M1 through M3, IOREG, well, I'll just put it in the show notes. It's a bunch of stuff.
We don't need commands and strings online.
This is an IOREG command with some flags with those two names that were read earlier.
This is like reading a URL out loud.
Yeah, I call myself, don't worry. Jonathan continues, the only thing that people should be concerned about storage-wise when buying a Mac is selecting the right size SSD for their needs. In most cases, selecting the next higher capacity drive will double the endurance and improve performance, but there's no underlying problem with the speed or endurance of any of the SSDs found in any of the M-series Macs at any capacity. However, if you fill the drive, performance can be severely impacted, so you really do want to avoid that. For those planning on using their Mac for 8 or more years, as I generally do, 256 gigs may become a pain point even for casual users. Fortunately, Apple will likely transition to 1 terabit NAND dies as soon as next year, and the 256 gig capacity will go the way of the dodo, just like the 8 gig as the entry-level RAM level did as well.
Hallelujah. We can't wait for that to happen. Although I still feel like a 512 might be small, but I think this rings true to me in all of our, you know, over a decade now doing the show or whatever. You don't hear a lot about people's SSDs going bad. I mean, they do. It does happen. Everything goes bad. Everything fails. But Apple has not historically had, as far as I know, any Macs that they've, especially in the ARM Mac era, any Apple Silicon Macs where the SSD was like really bad. I remember there was a big kerfuffle that we talked about on the show back when I think the M1s were first out, when they were like, oh, you buy with too little RAM and it's swapping to it. And there was something that tried to show how much life is left on how much endurance is left on the flash memory based on how many writes it's getting. And some tools reporting really huge numbers. And like, at this rate, your SSD will be dead in a year and a half. And that turned out mostly, I think, to be a problem with the tool reporting bad numbers and a problem with interpreting the numbers it did return. And in the end, people with M1 Macs didn't all have their SSDs fail after the first year, right? I mean, we're still using one right now, and it's fine. But I also agree that one of the things, well, macOS doesn't like this, and add to the pile now, NAND flash drives don't like this. Don't get close to the disk storage limit. Bad things happen. Bad, upsetting, terrible things happen. The operating system doesn't like it. The flash memory doesn't like it. It's just, you're just asking for trouble, which is why it really is important to get as big as an SSD as you can, or be very studious about getting stuff off of that SSD, because unfortunately, macOS is not great about helping you when you start pressing up against your disk limit. It will just sort of like complain feebly for a few seconds until it's too late, and then just keel over, and it'll be a sad situation.
Oh, goodness. All right. Any other follow-up? Excellent. So we got some repeated news, as it turns out, over the last 24-ish hours. M4 Extreme's chip, or the M4 Extreme chip, is unlikely after Apple, quote-unquote, cancels the high-performance chip. Reading from Mac Rumors, who is in turn quoting from the information, Apple is working on AI chip with Broadcom, is the title, the headline of the post on the information. Apple Silicon design team in Israel is leading development of the AI chip. That team was instrumental in designing the processors Apple introduced in 2020 to replace Intel chips and Macs. Apple this past summer canceled the development of a high-performance chip for Macs consisting of four smaller chips stitched together to free up some of its engineers in Israel to work on the AI chip, one of the people said, highlighting the company's shifting priorities. To make the chip, Apple is planning to use one of TSMC's most advanced manufacturing processes known as N3P. Apple plans to manufacture at least one of its iPhone chips next year using N3P. The other upcoming AI chips designed by OpenAI and NVIDIA are expected to use the process as well to improve performance. For its AI chip, Apple plans to utilize a chiplet design that AMD pioneered more than a decade ago. Rather than build a single chip with sections for different functions, Apple will break up the chip and functions into smaller pieces or chiplets and then stitch them back together as one. The design reduces the chip's manufacturing complexity and potential for defects.
So this was kind of, I don't know if this is a separate story or just confirmation of the vague rumor we got, I think, multiple years ago, which was, like, I think this was back when the M1 Extreme, the big M1, the quad M1 chip was canceled. And that was just an anonymous tip from, I don't even remember the sourcing, but it wasn't any particularly reliable source, but just something we were told. And it was, hey, if you're waiting for something on that size, the earliest it could possibly appear is the M7. And that was back when I think the M2 was just on the horizon or coming out. So M7, no chance of any chip like that until the M7, given the lead times. I don't know if this is...
To jump in really quickly, that, I believe, the original source of that was actually Upgrade, if I'm not mistaken, because someone had anonymously written to Upgrade. And because this was covered in Gruber's coverage of all this, he reminded me of, in his post, it reminded me of the feedback that Upgrade got, wherein someone allegedly with inside knowledge said, hey, this isn't going to happen until the M7 at the earliest.
Yeah, and I'm thinking maybe this team in Israel was the team working on the M7 thing, and then they just got pulled off. So, and now here's the thing. Many things are thwarting this chip, the fact that it's very expensive, the fact that Apple doesn't want to do it for such low volumes, you know, like this, you really need to believe in something like this to make it happen. It's, you know, as my blog post said, like the only way cars like the LFA happen at a company like Lexus is a bunch of people really, really want to make it happen because it just does not make economic sense, but it makes sense for the company and you need to have enough people who believe in that. That's the whole point of the Mac Pro Believe shirt, which will be coming back someday because its job is still not done. Mac Pro Believe shirt will be back next year at WWDC. Well, anyway, once again, Apple has found a reason not to make this chip, which it's pretty easy to do. And in this case, it makes some sense. Like, obviously, Apple, you know, AI is a big thing. Apple doesn't want to just pay Amazon to use all of its chips, although Apple recently, I think someone from Apple spoke at, like, the AWS reInvent to talk about how they're using all of Amazon's AI training chips and they're loving it and blah, 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 right? So, you know, Apple's doing what it has to do, but we also know from past stories we've discussed in the show that Apple has its own Apple Silicon and its own data centers running its own AI workloads with the private cloud computing thing that they made, supposedly a bunch of M2 Ultras, so on and so forth. Makes perfect sense that Apple would decide and, you know, to use its own silicon in its data center to run AI workloads. The M2 Ultra is not a chip that was really designed for that. It's designed to be in Macs. Making a purpose-built AI training inference, whatever, purpose-built Apple silicon for the data center for AI workloads makes sense, and I think Apple will do a good job at it. The rumors are that Apple is going to make that chip. Broadcom is helping them, yada, yada. They're not, as usual, Apple will not sell this chip to other people. It will just be a thing that Apple makes for its own data centers. So no customer will ever see this. They're not going to sell access to it like Amazon and Google and stuff do. It's just going to be for them. It'll probably be big and complicated and expensive. But what it won't be is a Mac Pro type chip, because obviously a lot of things that the Mac Pro needs to do, a chip inside a data center doing AI workloads does not need to do. And if you want people to make a big monster chip that can do this, probably the team that was working on the Mac Pro chip has the people that you need, and it's not like you can just leave them there and hire a bunch of new people. So I understand from a business perspective why they're doing this. And yet, if you're ever going to make a chip that makes sense in that gigantic case, you got to actually make one someday Or is it just going to be a series of Mac Studios in a giant case for the next 5 years? Stay tuned and find out.
I mean, they're also, in all fairness to them, this might not be purely economic. This might also be, you know, maybe they made these prototypes and they weren't as good as they thought. Because if you look at the Ultra chip, which is the two Macs, you know, talking to each other over the silicon interposer, it does not scale perfectly in all useful ways. There is some degree of overhead. The scaling is not complete. You don't get 2x of everything when you do that. You get close to 2x in certain ways, but sometimes more like 1.5x in other ways. So obviously they're not actually achieving perfect scaling. There's other bottlenecks somewhere or the limitations. Maybe when they tried a 4x design, they just couldn't, it just wasn't worth it, because maybe a 4x design, rather than reaching 4x performance, maybe it only reached 2.5x performance or something like that. Like, maybe it just wasn't technically compelling. And, you know, would you pay four times as much, or, you know, whatever? I'm sure the cost would be absurdly more expensive. Would you pay that much for, you know, quote, only two or three times the performance? Maybe not. And, you know, maybe they decided the better way to go was maybe to wait for something like a chiplet design, where they could do things like the parts that scale well, offer more of those, like the GPU cores maybe, and maybe not duplicate the entire chip design and all the other ways in order to achieve more GPU cores. Because, like, when you look at CPU performance, we're pretty, like, the CPU performance, I think, is probably what scales the worst as you add more cores here because of various limits and stuff. What the Mac Pro needs to be more competitive with, you know, its previous market as well as, you know, the current market, what it needs is more neural engine cores and or more GPU cores for certain configurations. So if they're moving to a system of chiplets, which sounds very promising, where they're able to isolate these components a bit more and to be able to, say, make a chip that keeps the same CPU core count as an Ultra but gives you twice the GPU core count, for instance, and to make that somewhat economically, you know, it's all relative, of course, but, you know, somewhat economically, that would be more compelling than if you doubled everything and didn't quite get, you know, all of that performance. So anyway, I think, I'm guessing the reason they canned the first quad was not purely economic. I'm guessing the reason it hasn't come back is also not purely economic. And if they are going to bring something like that to market, I bet it's going to take a very different strategy than just give us two Ultras glued together. I think it'll be more customized.
I was talking to Gruber about this. I'm way behind on Twitter, or not Twitter, sorry. I'm way behind on Mastodon for reasons we'll get into in a little bit. But I was talking to Gruber about this, but I didn't read his article about it. But anyway, one of the things I was saying was that, like, and we've discussed it in past episodes, I wish I could see what the M4 Max die looks like, because if it doesn't have an interposer, that means they're not going to stick two of them together to make an Ultra. And yeah, the nonlinear scaling of the Ultras versus the Maxes has been a problem. I think the M1 Max, M1 Ultra was the one that had really bad GPU scaling. Like, the GPU was the one thing that should scale close to linearly, and it wasn't because of interconnect issues. So what I've always been hoping was that the M3 or M4 Ultra will not be two Maxes stuck together, but instead will be a dedicated custom chip that just has more stuff in the right things. Single die, you know, single massive, super expensive die, but not two Maxes stuck together. Because the two Maxes stuck together approach made some sense economically and it was worth a try, but I think with two tries at it with the M1 and M2 Ultra, it's a little bit wasteful. It doesn't have the greatest performance benefits. And that's not always the worst thing, though, by the way, because when you're shopping for high-end stuff, very often you are paying much, much more for just a little bit more performance. That's why it's so important to essentially make the fastest whatever that you can make, because you can say, well, look, it is five times more expensive for only two times the speed, but is literally the fastest thing that you can get. So if you want to spend money and get the fastest thing, if that makes a difference to your business or to your job or whatever, that you just want the fastest, you don't care that the price doesn't scale linearly with performance, you just want the fastest. But you do want something that, you know, performs as good as possible, and part of that is not wasting performance and money on overhead that's not giving you better performance. So, you know, one of the things I was hoping before reading the story was that the M4 Ultra would appear, and it would not be two M4 Maxes stuck together, but it would be its own dedicated chip, and it would be really powerful, and then the Extreme would be two of those stuck together. You know what I mean? And so that they could design them in that way so that that gives you a more economical extreme because you're just taking two ultras, but the two ultras have their parts arranged such that it makes a little bit more sense to put them together. Yeah, and the chiplet design, once you get to a certain size, like the ultra with the interposer, that's basically pushing the limit. We talked about this before, the reticle limit. Like, how big can you even make things? Not just economically, but practically speaking at
physically.
All. So yeah, so everyone's doing a chiplet type design. And yeah, we keep referring to it at the quad because we're basically trying to say something twice as big as an ultra, but it doesn't mean four of anything. It just means count up all the stuff, count up all the transistors, all the die area, something that is twice as big as an ultra. That's when we're doing all the back of the envelope math, like how many GPU cores and what it would be competitive with, assuming the GPU scale is close to linearly. So I'm not holding out for four of anything stuck together. I just want something that is roughly sized like four of those things with a much better arrangement of parts, less used than overhead. I don't need four copies of the Thunderbolt controllers. I don't need four different media encoders and only one of which is used at a time. You know, like they can do better. But anyway, it just seems like this is not going to be in the cards for a long time. So now the only thing I have left to hope for is that the Ultra will be better than the previous Ultras, hopefully by not being two Maxes stuck together, but just being a dedicated Ultra that is its own thing. And if it is two Maxes stuck together, that they've resolved the issues. Because, again, my memory says this, but I seem to recall the M1 Ultra, the GPU scaling was really terrible because of some thing that they didn't do right in the some buffer or something was under-resourced somewhere, and it really killed the performance. And that's just a shame because the GPU transistors were there. They had enough of them. If they were all in the same die, they would have worked great. But because they were separated and because there was a problem with the interconnect, you lost a lot of performance. So we'll see. But yeah, this is, not that it was ever likely that I was going to get the next Mac Pro, but it's definitely looking more like Mac Studio for me. Hopefully the M4 Ultra will be good.
It'll be weird for you not to have a Mac Pro. I mean, I don't think it's unreasonable for the record, but it'll be weird.
I mean, I probably will just keep it here because the studio, like, it can continue to be here like a piece of furniture, and the studio will just be on the desk. It's so small. Doesn't take him any room.
I mean, if you get a second one, you could make them into a desk. Just take, the two legs, get a tabletop or a door, and just stick it across the top, and there you go.
That'd be amazing.
That's what people do with the old cheese graters, but they're a little low, and I would never do that.
Those are better for benches.
Yeah.
All right, John. So potentially in preparation for you getting a Mac Studio, you've been doing some house cleaning. What's going on?
Yeah, so we talked on the show.
You're so pained by this.
Yeah, I know. Seriously, I'm scared.
I can't remember. I think we were talking about maybe we were talking about our photos workflows or something on the member special. But anyway, to refresh everyone's memory, I have a shared iCloud photo library thing. I love it. My wife and I are both in the same shared library. Essentially, all of our photos are in the shared library. I think pretty much all of her photos are in there. I keep some photos out of the shared library. They're mostly screenshots of videos about Destiny stuff. my wife doesn't need to see that. So it's like, So those are my, but I have a very small, and also the pictures of the backs of appliances and stuff like that. Those are in my personal library. But for basically everything else is in a massive 200,000 plus photo shared library, right? And because Apple hasn't really finish the fight in Halo parlance on the shared photo library, some things are still not shared, like albums and people. And so I still need to switch to my wife's account on my Mac sometimes to do photo stuff, because if I were to do them in my account, it wouldn't have any effect because they're not shared in the shared photo library. So anyway, she has an account on my Mac. I switched to it. Her account is set to download originals. So our full photo library is on my Mac through her account because it's set to download originals. It gets backed up with the whole rest of my Mac, right? But also on my account is my photo library. And when I launch photos, I'm essentially looking at the same photo library that she's looking at, the shared library, right? She's set to download originals. My account is set to the optimized storage thing. But practically speaking, there's 200,000 photos. And when you go to her account, you can see those 200,000 photos. When you go to my account, you can see those 200,000 photos. And somebody wrote in a while back, and I think we talked about it on SKTP or something, asking, does macOS does Photos do anything smart with the fact that it's the same shared library and two accounts on the same Mac? Or if I set my account to download originals, would it download two complete copies of my library? And I told this person, I think it will download two complete copies of your library, and it's incredibly wasteful that it does that, but, that's a pretty tricky scenario, right? Anyway, we had that discussion a while back, but it had been sticking in my mind going, I wonder, especially as my disk fills and I get close to my storage limit and I'm always like fighting against that, how much space am I wasting on my Mac by having the same photo library as hers downloading originals and mine not? But like, how much stuff is it downloaded? So, you know, I've got Perl. I can find the answer to this question.
Oh, my word. Of course you turn to Perl. Why would you? Why wouldn't you just use Finder? But no, Perl exists. So I'll use
Well,
Perl.
I can't use Finder because it's in her account, right?
Why not use PHP? I mean, you now know that.
Oh, God. Really? using PHP for an extended amount has made me hate it more, if that's even possible.
I didn't think that was possible.
But it has happened. Anyway, so I wrote a little Perl script and it ran it as root. So
what could possibly go wrong?
See, right? The files, I've been running Perl as root since before you were out of high school. Anyway, ran my script, and it crawled over her photo library, my photo library, and found all the files that are identical. And I was actually, well, first, here's the file count. Any guesses?
Are we including like all the little previews it generates and everything?
I'm not excluding any files.
Oh,
it's just
God.
Like there's like a directory called like whatever .photolibrary, like .photolibrary is the extension, but it's a directory, and in there is a bunch of stuff that Photos uses to keep track of your files. So obviously the originals are in there in my wife's account, but also all the other crap of like the thumbnails and previews and stuff like that.
I'm gonna say 2 million.
No, yeah, identical identical files, not files total.
Oh, okay. Oh, let's see.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say like 200K.
73,000 files were identical.
Okay.
Oh, that's actually fewer than I thought.
All right, but now keep in mind, my photo library is, how big is it? Maybe like 2.5 terabytes, 3 terabytes, 200,000 photos. That's how big it is. So it's like, oh, I got to see some major savings here. Turns out there's only 8.6 gigs duplicated. Now, I don't know if that's because I kind of stay away from my photo library, don't like scroll back in time and like load the full resolution images and stuff or whatever. I mostly just look at the pictures that have just come in. You know, I'm not really going back in time and doing stuff, but only 8.6 gigs. But I was like, you know what? I want those 8.6 gigs back.
Oh, here we go. You couldn't just leave well enough alone.
No, because that's the whole point of this. The person was asking, like, does the OS do something smart about this? Like, does it share them and only have one copy or whatever? And I was like, I can get those 8.6 gigs back.
Can I guess how?
But you should know how, because we talked about it on the show before. But yeah, go ahead.
Are you going to use the special cp copy command that does the APFS deduplication thing for the same file?
Yeah, I'm not going to use a cp command like an animal. But yeah, the APFS, the file system that macOS and phone and iOS and all the other devices use, Apple's file system, has a feature that lets you make a, quote, clone of a file, where you get a complete independent copy of that file essentially for free, because it shares the storage with the other file, and not like a hard link or a symlink or an alias, not like that. Not like where when you edit one file, the other one gets edited. They are two completely distinct files. They do not affect each other in any way, but while they are identical, they share the same storage. If you duplicate a file in the Finder, go to your Finder now, find a 10 gig file and make 1,000 duplicates. You will not take up any more space except for the space required to store the file names of those files. That's why duplicates in the Finder are instant. Go to find a 300 gig file, hit duplicate, and be like, why was there no progress bar? You know why? Because it's just cloning the file. It's saying, those blocks on disk, now there's another way to get at them. And again, it doesn't tie them together like a symlink or an alias or a hard link. They're not linked in a way when you edit one file, it will edit all the other copies. They're completely independent. They will diverge as you edit them. It's the magic of copy on write. It's one of the advantages of having a modern file system. And most people don't even think about it, but the cp command from the command line will do this. Although there is a flag to tell it to do it. If you don't even pass the flag, it does it all the time anyway. The Finder will do it when you duplicate. That's why your file copies are instant. I do it all the time for podcast recordings. When I record a podcast, whatever folder ended up in, Audio Hijack for this show or whatever, I copy it into a like separate folder, which is just like all the shows I've recorded, like from going back in time. That doesn't take up any more space. I just copy it. I also copy it into Dropbox. I'm not sure how Dropbox handles that, but it gets to leave that Dropbox pretty soon. But anyway, I can get the space back. Take those 73,000 files. And every one of them that I find that where there's identical content in my photo library, clone the one from her photo library into my photo library and throw out the one that was in my photo library. Because they have identical content. And you got to do it carefully, because just because they have identical content, they're still different files. They have different creation dates, different modification dates, different owners, different permissions, different finder labels, different comments, different access control lists, different extended attributes. tons of stuff about these files is different, but not the data. Different resource forks, maybe, but not the data, right?
I love that you're going through all of this on a computer. This isn't on her computer, right? This is on your computer?
Yep.
Why? You could put another friggin' hard drive in your machine. Why are you going through all this pain?
Well, it's not pain. The first Perl script to find out how many files were the same, real quick.
I think it's overkill, but I'm behind it in principle. But doing this, like, you know, swapping in place within the Photos library mega air quotes database. Mm-hmm. Oof. Oh no.
Yeah.
Thank
so
you.
That's one of the things. It's like, okay, well, how can I do this in a way where I feel like I'm not hosing myself, right? Aside from just being a good, careful programmer with experience with Perl, one of the ways I decided to tackle this was, I will choose her library as the source and mine as the target. So I will only read from hers and only write to mine, because hers is like the canonical good one where it's downloaded originals, blah, blah, blah. And mine is not. Worst case scenario, I just delete my photo library and re-iCloud it, because there's so little is actually in my photo library proper. It's all in the shared library, right? So that's what I did. I used hers as the source, mine as the destination, to copy the files. I did it in a couple of different steps. One is I needed to be able to find out if the files were already clones of each other. I forgot to mention this, but I did that as part of the Perl script. I couldn't find a good way to do that, except someone eventually, I eventually found someone on GitHub who had a tool that did a best effort at it. And as far as I could tell, it worked. I did a bunch of test cases. It always got the right answer. It essentially walks the entire extents tree for each of the files and sees if they're identical, which is... it's not great, but it's the only way that you can do it. There's a bunch of little flags and stuff about, there's even one called like may share content or may share blocks. Like may, well, that's not really helpful to me. I need to know if they do share blocks, right? So you basically just have to walk the whole extents tree. So I use, that was written in C. I have my thing written in Perl. There's a command on the Mac called ditto that will copy a file with all of its metadata and stuff. And then I wrote in Swift a thing to do the extended attributes, creation dates, blah, blah, blah. Some things you can't restore, because I think there's a thing called like an access time or attribute modification time that you can't actually update. Like it gets updated by the file system and you have no way to, there's no APIs for updating it, but I don't think anything really uses that. So anyway, I was comfortable that it would be, say, if I did a test on one or two files, I looked at before and afters, I examined them with every tool I had and said the before and the after file really do look identical in every way that I can determine that I care about. And so I just ran it. I got 8.6 gigs back.
Right? I'm so happy for you.
And then I thought, you know, free disk space.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Free disk space.
Oh, no, John.
My computer has not lost anything. Obviously, there are fewer redundant copies of bits on the SSD, but I'm not relying on the redundancy of the bits on my SSD to save those things. That's what backups are for.
Oh, God.
RAID is not a backup, neither is having multiple copies. But anyway, free disk space.
That's like free opium. Like, what could possibly go wrong?
Free real estate. I'm not doing free opium. Free real estate. Free disk real estate. I thought to myself, most people don't know about this APFS cloning thing. It's too nerdy. But everyone likes free disk space. Right? Like literally free. And if you go to the Mac App Store, you'll find tons of like file deduplicators that will find duplicate files, but it wants you to delete the other ones. Like they all offer like, I know, we'll delete them. We'll save the newest one. We'll save this, you know, but like, no, cloning doesn't make you make that choice. You don't lose any files. All the files stay exactly the way they were. Right?
Are you about to launch an app? Don't do this. Don't do this to yourself. The support burden will be terrible.
You can have all sorts of like, you know, creepy marketing about it. Like, you can get free resources from your computer. Just give me $40.
Yeah, but like, right? But it's a technical ability that people aren't leveraging on their own because it's too onerous to do it. Like, you can't. I wouldn't find 73,000 files by myself. So anyway, I thought this would be a good idea for a Mac app.
Oh no, John.
I wrote it.
Oh, my God. Are you launching it, like, right now?
No. Well, here. So, I've written the Perl scripts. So I'm like, this couldn't be that hard to make as a Mac app.
Don't use the Perl scripts in the app, for God's sake.
Oh,
no,
absolutely.
No, come on. The whole point of making it as an app is no more Perl scripts. No, you know, like, real, honest-to-goodness app. I like doing Mac development, and my apps are essentially feature-complete, although I do have a couple ideas for one of them. But anyway, it was exciting to start a new app. I made a Swift UI lifecycle app, started from scratch, wrote it up. I did the programmer's UI that you're all familiar with, which is a giant window with a bunch of text and buttons on it. With no UI and no styling, just text, buttons, and rapidly changing numbers, right?
Nice.
Love it. Love the programmer UI. And yeah, no, it worked. And while I was doing this, I was like, you know, someone already wrote this program, and I should just like stop what I'm doing and use theirs. Eventually, I remembered someone did write the program. We talked about it on the show. I feel like Casey now. We talked about it on the show. I already had it installed in my applications folder. it's a pay app that I bought years ago. It already exists. So I will put a link in the show notes. It's called Disk Dedupe by Frank Schroeder. I'm not sure how many years old it is, but it is. It does exactly what my app is trying to do. It's not the most polished app in the world, but it's been developed for a little while. It's on like version 1.3 or something. It's available on the Mac App Store. You can get it right now if you feel like it. But I'm still making my app. Other people made podcast players too, but it didn't stop Marco.
Yeah, that's true.
He still made Overcast. And the reason I'm making the app just because I like doing Mac development. It's fun. And I think there is a place in the market for a slightly more polished version of this. But I'm doing it for a couple other reasons as well. One is after I got like, 1,000 lines into this app and it was basically working, but with an ugly UI, I thought, you know, let me not make the same mistake that everyone else always makes. I should turn on Swift 6 language mode.
No.
I hadn't at that point. And so that, burned a day. Right. But still, you do it when there's 1,000 lines. It's better than doing it when there's 100,000.
Right. Fair.
And there's a lot I don't know about concurrency, but I figured it out. Right. The other thing I'm concerned about is this is an incredibly dangerous app. Like, if I'm not careful, right? It essentially deletes and then reincarnates arbitrary files that it knows nothing about. Right?
Yeah, that's not dangerous.
Because that's what it does. Like, it doesn't, if you point it at a directory, it doesn't know what those files are. It just knows these two files have the same content, and I'm going to magically do some magic with cloning, and when I'm done, you won't notice anything has changed. But while I'm doing it, I hope no one's looking at those files. Unfortunately, macOS being a Unix derivative does not have a really great way to tell if someone else is messing with a file. You want to run LSOF on every file, it will take a year and a day, and the kernel will get angry at you. And even that is not going to tell you anything because there's a million race conditions. You only have advisory locking. You don't have mandatory locking like on Windows. Yada, yada, yada. The point is, it's a potentially dangerous app. But then on the other hand, that's why a polished version of this that's very cautious and careful maybe has a place in the market because, no, people are never going to do this on their own. They're not going to run a Perl script. They're not going to run a Perl script as root like I did that calls out to a Swift program that they wrote in a C program that they downloaded from GitHub. Like, no one's going to do that. They just want a polished single Mac app that does all the stuff. So anyway, I am going to eventually make that app. It is essentially working now. It just has half a UI. I'm noodling with the UI to try to make it not heinously ugly. But I'm having fun. And the other thing I'm going to do with it is, so the existing app that does this is a paid up front app. I'm going to make mine free, but with in-app purchase because it's so ideal. Like, you get the app for free, you try it, it tells you how much space you can save. If you can't save any space, you don't, fine, whatever. But if it turns out you can save 10 gigs, then you get the in-app purchase. And that gives me an opportunity to play with in-app purchase, which I've literally never written in any app before. So I want to do in-app purchase in a Mac app this time to see what that experience is like, because it could be fun.
Yeah,
I mean, you're telling me a StoreKit testing is never fun. I understand, but you know what I mean.
God, it's not. It's gotten better, but it's real rough.
It's StoreKit 2, Casey. It's not just regular StoreKit.
No, that's what I'm using. And
I know,
it's still trash.
I know.
It's still trash. Like, it's gotten a lot better, but it's still
my
trash.
In-app purchase will be fairly simple. But anyway,
you say that.
So the final thing to say here is I have a Casey-level naming dilemma going on now.
Oh, yeah, no. Good luck. Good luck.
Because here's the thing with naming. I have very particular opinions about app naming.
Everything.
On the Mac. But when you make a new project in Xcode, they make you pick a name for the project. And if you don't know what your app is going to be named, you got to call it something. This is how Casey ends up with his stuff, I imagine, as well, right?
Yep. This is,
it is
honestly
exactly right.
That is one of the reasons why I typically cannot start a new project until I have
until you have the name.
Like,
yeah.
I can't make myself do it with a placeholder name.
Yeah, I'll say, here's the other thing about names. Depending on which naming theme I'm going with, I very often have spaces between words. But if you put spaces between words in your Xcode project, it puts underscores and files, and it's just
it messes it all up.
And then if you go, okay, well, put underscores in files, I'll just remove those underscores. But then your whole project is screwed up because you haven't found every reference to that file, and it's just like you gotta. So, obviously, I made a project, and I gave it a name, is not going to be the name of the app.
Is it,
what'd you call it?
Flisk Space?
It's not as bad as a Casey name, but it might as well be. Here, my thinking on the name, I talked about this briefly with Merlin on the Rectifs that will come out in a little bit. My other apps are a little bit more fanciful in names, but this one I actually want people to find when they're searching for something that does what it does.
Yeah, this is like
so
an SEO
I can't
name.
Just call it, I can't just call it like lemonade or something that's just like, you know,
right.
Just nothing that has anything to do with anything, even though it might be good branding to come up with like a very unique, interesting name. No one will ever find it. I don't know. I don't trust the App Store search and my keywords and my description or whatever. So I want the name to at least give you a hint that it might have something to do with disks or storage or duplicate files or something like that. And that really puts you in squarely into the namespaces of the million other apps to delete duplicate files that are on the Mac App Store. So I'm not quite sure what it's going to be called. As soon as I know, I will let you know. But the app's not quite done yet. So,
can you think about like words that are like about like finding resources out in the world, yeah. Like you know, mining, miner, stuff like that. Or
no, you can't do mining.
Yeah, but like
janitor,
any word that you
know,
yeah,
like
that's like a Bitcoin
stuff.
Thing. Any word like that, I would want to put like disk in, but disk, people don't have disks anymore. They don't even think of it as disks. It's certainly not hard drive.
I would use it. I would call it, if you're going to refer to the medium, I would call it storage or space or something like that. But ideally, you shouldn't have to. But yeah. I don't know. Yeah, that's a tough one.
Any guesses at what my working title is? What the name of the Xcode project is?
Oh no,
I don't want to guess. But I think it's got to have been overdone a trillion times. But the obvious answer for this is Highlander, because there can be only one.
Yeah, there already is an app called Highlander, obviously. One of the names I came up with, obviously it's not a real name that I would use for reasons that you'll understand in a second. Super Deduper.
Wow.
That's pretty good, actually.
Because Dave Nanyan would come to my house and beat me up.
Yes, but it's still pretty good, though.
That's called Trade Dress. Maybe, if I try to name my app after a well-known, beloved, multi-decade-old...
Also about storage.
Yeah, which is also a Super Duper, in case people don't know. Yeah, Mac cloning app that I, in fact, use to clone my hard drive. So Super Duper. There's also Carbon Copy Cloner. But anyway, Super Deduper would be a great name if we were at the same company, but we're not.
How about Canonical? It's a terrible name, but...
Isn't that a whole software company?
That's a disc. I might have to give up on the people can guess that it's a disc thing.
Yeah, I don't know. That's tough. I mean, naming anything these days, you know, anything in tech is a very crowded market these days. And naming something that solves a common problem that has existed for a very long time, like freeing up disk space in your computer,
That's
going to be extra difficult because there's going to be
Space Doubler.
So many.
Oh, wait. Yeah, you guys don't remember Space Doubler, but it was the name of a classic macOS utility. Didn't do this, but it was another thing that, like, I think it was like a compression, on-the-fly compression thing.
The funny, you know, Stacker is one of those, too. And the funny thing is that name actually kind of makes sense here.
Yeah.
Real time follow up. I knew I recognized Canonical from somewhere. They're the people who do Ubuntu. Yeah. I can't believe I didn't realize that immediately. But
okay.
That's why I knew it.
So anyway, a few more things, like now that I have this program up and running, it's obviously a two-phase thing. One where you scan where it tells you how many duplicates it found, and two is where you consolidate them. And so I've been doing a lot of scanning, especially when developing the app. I pointed it at my documents folder. Believe it or not, only 14,000 documents, but 12 gigs more duplicates in my own, just in my documents folder, my own documents folder only, than there was when I was cross comparing the two photo libraries that ostensibly are both looking at the shared library. 12 gigs in my documents library. Dropbox, I'm probably just going to literally forbid in my app you ever pointing it at Google Drive, Dropbox, or anything, because I have no freaking idea what Dropbox will do when I yank the file out from under it and replace it with a clone.
Yep. That's better.
I'm just
going to
be like,
touched.
Nope. Not anything that's running on a file provider type API thing like Google Drive, OneDrive, my app is just going to flat out refuse to do, just for safety reasons, probably. Yep. But anyway, I got a gig, 626 files in Dropbox. My home/library folder, which I will also forbid for what I hope are obvious reasons, stuff that's in your library is like stuff that other apps are using that you have no idea when they're touching it. Right, things that are being touched by the cfprefs daemon, containers, sandbox containers, whatever. 15 gigs in my library folder. 15 gigs of duplications. So that's the type of situation where you shouldn't run it, but I might run my Perl script on it.
John, I am in full support of you doing this for yourself. I am at best half-hearted support in you selling this as a product, because I feel like the support burden would just be awful. It will be ruinous. And then you're going to not do a bunch of work for ATP that I've been happy to have been doing recently.
That's the whole point of this program, is like the one I said, the disk dedupe thing or whatever, that has been on the Mac App Store, it doesn't really have any guardrails. It will just do what you tell it to do for the most part, right? And I don't think it's a very popular program, and I haven't really heard about it, despite the fact that I apparently bought it years ago. Even I didn't use it that often. I want to make something that's more polished, that has enough guardrails that it will prevent you from really hosing yourself, right? Like, really cautious in what it does, just totally refusing to do anything that it knows is potentially dangerous. And it's, in terms of support burden, like, we'll see. It could be, like, this is one of the things that was preventing me from doing it. Like, oh, you're just making an app for people to host themselves, and now they're going to be angry, and you're not going to get 1-star reviews or whatever.
But, yep.
But this app is already on the Mac App Store. It's got great reviews. It has no guardrails. People love it. So maybe, like, yeah, people find the apps find their audience.
I mean, look, so, I am an expert in bad ideas. And I don't think this is not jumping out at me as a bad idea. So I think that you might be onto something here. This might be a good thing for you to do. It is a risk. I think, you know, like any new app, it will be way more time-consuming than you think it will. The support burden will be larger than you expect and predict, and it will be difficult to market it, even though you have one of the best marketing channels in the indie Apple scene by, you know, your existing presence in the internet and on this podcast, on your blog, and everything else. But I think you could do it, and I think you could do a good job of it, and some people would buy it. I don't know how the heck you're going to price it. I don't know anything about this market, but
yeah,
you can make it happen.
Here's the thing. Any, like, competent, experienced Mac developer could bang this out between the time this podcast is released and, anyone who's good at Mac development could do this so much faster than I will. Part of the reason I'm doing it is because I enjoy Mac development, which is a thing I discovered from my other two apps. I just enjoy doing it, period. And I'll learn a lot one of the things I enjoy is learning stuff, but, like, I am by no means an experienced Mac developer. I am stumbling my way through this, so it's going to take me a long time. Anybody good, like one of the many good Mac developers that are out there that make these things, like Guy Rambo probably made this app already while we've been discussing it. You know what I mean? And they'll do a better job than me too, but maybe they're not interested in that market. Maybe they know that this is a dangerous tool for it to be. I just don't understand why more people haven't made. This is probably not the only one. The one I found that there's probably other apps that also do this. When we discussed it on the show, I think I probably said someone should totally make an app like that. And then someone said, here's this app. And then I bought it. And right. Like, so this is not a new idea. I just think this is an idea that more people should be implementing. And if people aren't going to do it, then I will do it. And again, even if they do it, I'm still going to do it anyway because I'm having fun. And if it turns out to be a disaster, I just pull the app from the store.
To be absolutely clear, as your friend, I'm nervous for you and I don't love it. As your co-host, oh, hell yes, because we will get so much good stuff out of it.
You say that until I want both of you to run it for the show.
Okay, maybe not.
I'll give you the source code. You can look at it. You can step through it in the debugger to see that it's not really doing anything terrible.
Oh, my gosh.
No, honestly,
I'm certainly stepping through it in the debugger.
I mean, I think there is, honestly, like, there is a lot to be said for taking something that, anybody, you know, any programmer can write a script to do this in a couple hours at most. And, you know, there is something to be said for wrapping that idea and functionality in a really nice app. Yeah. And there is a market for that. And honestly, you know, there's a lot when you look at, like, iOS, because it is so big, it's the entire world is iOS. And as a result, it is hyper competitive. Every dollar is squeezed out of everything. There you are, like, you can't get an iota of attention on iOS without paying for it, and you're going to be competing with everyone else who's paying for it with all the money they're making from their scam subscriptions and all that other crap that goes on iOS. Like, it's a brutal market on iOS. Big,
you can't
but
do
brutal.
Apps like this on iOS at all anyway.
True, but just like, just kind of like, you know, the dynamics of the market on iOS are just cutthroat and brutal, and it's hard to do something like nice there as an indie. It really is hard. On the Mac, though, I think part of the beauty of the Mac software ecosystem that I think really peaked a lot in like the, you know, the mid 2000s and maybe 2010s, and we've kind of been going down since then, is people who were really just making nice versions of simple tasks, like apps that did something that, yeah, anybody could write something to do that, but here's a really nice version of it, and it's $20 or whatever, $40. Like, that was a huge part of the Mac indie software scene, and that's what part of what drew a lot of us to the Mac in that time span. And a lot of that has either faded or has been lost since then. And so I love the idea of you going into this and doing something like this, even though, like, if you look at, like, okay, what, how should you spend your money, or how should you spend your time to maximize the amount of money you can make with Apple platform software? This probably is not the answer, but that's not your goal. Your goal is to make something nice on the Mac. And I think that we need more of that. And I really miss the era of that being like the thing we were all really paying attention to and doing and using. So this could be great. And, you know, selfishly, it's easy for me to say this because I don't have to handle the support load that you do. But I think this could be a very good idea. Or it could just fizzle out and do nothing and make you another, you know, $10. But it's a, I think odds are, if you finish this and release it and let me pick your price, I think you'll make more money from this than your other two apps combined.
Yeah, this definitely has more potential customers, but also it's much more potentially dangerous. Like, the thing about being an indie developer
price it per gig saved.
I'm not going to be that. You're thinking of iOS. This is the Mac.
Yeah, it's a terrible idea. Don't do that.
Yeah. The thing about being an indie developer,
you can compete with Apple storage prices.
right.
But that's kind of what led me to this whole discussion of storage. But like when you're running like a company, you can think about like what kind of product should our company make in terms of product market fit and total addressable market and so on and so forth. But when you're an indie developer, you're in the situation where essentially you can't pick what you're interested in building. Like, and if you're lucky, you're interested in building an app that has wide appeal. But if you're unlucky like me, every app you want to make does not have wide appeal. But that's what you want to make, right? Like, even when I was thinking of doing a Mastodon client, which is a much more difficult task, and I started it and turned out I didn't like iOS development that much, right? Because I like doing Mac development. The apps that I'm interested in making are weird, right? And so it's like, I mean, it's just right up my alley. I love file system stuff. I love, like, this actually surprisingly large overlap between this app and the stuff I did in my web dev career, because I did a lot of, high-scale back-end things. One of the biggest things I made was, like, an S3-like service that had to deal with all sorts of file system things in addition to being a web service type thing, right? So I do actually have relevant experience here. And you just don't get to pick what you're interested in when you're an indie. You're interested in what you're interested in. So you end up making what you want to make. And if you're lucky, you get something that overlaps with a lot of customers. But if you're unlucky, you can't force yourself to be like, I should make a to-do app. I don't want to make a to-do app, right? Never mind that market is saturated anyway. But whatever, like anything with wide appeal, right? So, or if you're a very skilled developer, you can just, you know, do the underscore method, and you have so many interests in so many apps, and you can churn them out so quickly that you make lots of bets, and eventually some of them pay off. But you have to be, a really good experienced developer to do that, and B, I think underscore actually is legitimately interested in every app that he makes.
Yeah,
he's just he's got a wide ranging interest. My interests are narrower and more obscure, and this is one of them. Unfortunately for me, and potentially unfortunately for the world.
Well, again, I am in full support of this as a co-host. I am sort of in support of it as a friend. I just, the support burden is what worries me so deeply. Like, everything else about it, I think, heck yeah. But I am deeply concerned about the support burden. But if you say you're comfortable with, you know, shouldering that, then power to you. Let's do it.
You're definitely going to want the LLC protection on this one.
It's not a very complicated app in terms of, you know, there's not a lot of complicated UI that people are going to have trouble with. It's just only going to be a question of, you broke my computer and deleted all my files. But it's pretty, not as easy, but like, you, if you're super cautious in your app, you can severely limit the damage. I mean, my evidence is the Disk Deduper app that's on the Mac App Store now is not bombarded with terrible reviews.
Yeah.
People like it. People like getting free disk space back, and the operation it's performing is not complicated. It's officially supported. You can put it in the Mac App Store. It's not using private APIs. It's pretty straightforward, you know?
Do you think full disk access be an annoying limitation?
Turns out you don't need it. Because it's very confusing on macOS. One of the things I discovered is it does not work the way you think it does.
What?
I was in one of the Mac development channels discussing, like, how does full disk access interact with sandboxing, interact with user expressed intent through the open save dialog box? I don't need full disk access for this app.
That's bananas.
I can't believe that.
Yeah,
you and me both. I couldn't believe it either, but I literally don't need it because everything that it does is user initiated. Like, and once you get a user initiated permission through the open save dialog box, I essentially have full access to the thing that they chose to open in the app.
So the only thing I'm thinking about is like the root of the drive, basically. And then
they just pick whatever folder they want to dedupe. So they pick their documents folder and that's it.
But what if they want to dedupe everything, their whole system?
They shouldn't do that. And my app will probably stop them because that's bad. Now, one of the things I'm also looking into for a future version of this goes well is a privileged helper tool where you ask for admin permissions. So you can do cross account, yada, yada, yada. But just version one is just files that you own in your home directory. There's data, there's space to be saved there.
No, of all the things I thought we were talking about tonight, this was not on the list. So
no, saving space.
Saving space. Yeah. I mean, literally the show notes, our internal show notes read, John is saving space. Photos, iCloud shared library, multiple accounts on the same Mac. That's all we
when
had.
When I wrote that in the show notes, I hadn't done anything except for muse about it. In between the time I wrote that and now, I wrote a Perl script and wrote a Mac app.
Very good stuff. This is why we love you. All right. Well, I am looking forward to this corner of the podcast going forward.
Just
this is
send in your
very
names.
Exciting. Oh, very cool. All right. We have semi-breaking news. I think it was yesterday afternoon. iOS 18.2, macOS 15.2, visionOS 2.2 all launched, and I was not on the beta train on anything for the .2 releases, and I have been very excited to try the .2 releases, the 15.2 and visionOS 2.2 releases, macOS 15.2 and visionOS 2.2, because this gives us the new fancy Mac virtual display. So if you are not caught up, the way it worked up until literally yesterday as we record this is that if you wanted to kind of suck your Mac into the visionOS world, you could use either the visionOS control center, or if you have a laptop, you can just look at your laptop and a little button will appear over it. This is when you have your Vision Pro on. A little button will appear over your laptop that says connect. And then it'll, whatever, you know, laptop or even desktop, if you go in through visionOS's control center, whatever computer you're bringing into the visionOS, you get a 4K display in visionOS. And you can resize that display insofar as you can make it, you know, the equivalent of 10 feet in front of your face, but it's still only ever 4K. And I've used this a handful of times. I used it kind of a lot when traveling, but I don't travel that often. So I've only used it a little bit here and there. And I've used it on the train and on the plane, and it's very, very cool and really nice that not only do you have a large display in a train or in a plane, but nobody can see what's happening on your Mac. It's not like, you know, screen sharing where a lot of times your Mac will be displaying what's on screen and then some other computer's also displaying it. When you do this Mac virtual display thing, the Mac screen or screens go dark. And so no passerby or bystander or whatever, looky-loo, can see what's going on. And I always thought this was good. It wasn't perfect, wasn't stellar, but it was good. And I typically do this with the developer strap on my Vision Pro. If you recall, you can replace the right-hand side AudioPod, I think they call it, which in the strap that it's a part of, and you can get one that has a little USB-C dongle on it. Then you can plug USB-C from the Vision Pro into your computer, and it will actually do Mac virtual display over that rather than like local Wi-Fi or whatever. And I always thought it was good. Maybe even great. I don't know, somewhere between good and great. Marco, up until yesterday, if I recall correctly, you found the Mac virtual display to be a little bit blurry and you didn't really care for it very much. Is that accurate?
I would say that's an understatement, but yeah.
Okay, fair enough. So yesterday we got the new Mac virtual display, which does a few things. I believe the standard display is now 5K instead of 4K. Additionally, you have two other modes that you can optionally choose between. You can choose between, what do they call it?
Wide and ultra wide.
Thank you. Wide and ultra wide. Now, I should also note that up until yesterday, even the standard display was, well, there was, that was the only option you had, and it was flat. Whereas now all of the displays are curved a little bit, which generally is not something I particularly care for, but in this context, I think does make a fair bit of sense. God help me if I end up buying like one of these 40 inch curved computer displays for my desk.
In all fairness, I would say, like, based on the virtualized size of them, the wide and ultra wide, I think basically have to be curved, especially the ultra wide. It takes up, like, I mean, I'm just estimating here, maybe like 90 degrees of your field of view. So if that was just a big flat pane window in the view, the left and right edges would be substantially further away from your eyes than the center would be. It would be a little weird.
Yeah. So they added wide and ultra wide, and wide is, let's see. So the standard, I forget the resolutions. Oh, here we go. So when I was in ultra wide mode, it offered 5120 by 1440, which is the default, and up to 10240 by 2880, which is bananas. But suffice to say, I have tried this out. Holy freaking crap, this is amazing. I am so in love with this. Now, if you recall, I'm the kind of lunatic, and this is partially Marco's fault for having sent me one, but I'm the kind of lunatic that runs three 5K displays at home. I have my studio display directly in front of my face. Then I have, at, you know, like a 45 degree angle to either side, I have LG Ultrafine 5Ks. So I'm used to having an overabundance of real estate, and I'm used to having to move my head in order to use my computer. I don't mind that. I think the juice is worth the squeeze for me personally. The ultra wide is so freaking big in the Vision Pro that I actually think it might even be too much. And I am so happy that that is the problem I have, that this might be too much. It is unreal. I have many more thoughts about this, but I'd like to pause myself and hear, Marco, you were assigned yet more homework. And listeners, I have to tell you, Marco's been a very good sport about all the homework I've assigned, and you have done more homework, and I appreciate you, and I appreciate that. Rain on my parade, and then I'll go back to telling you about how amazing it is.
Honestly, if you try it and you like it, more power to you. Where I am with the Vision Pro is I have my feelings about it. I can tell you how well it works for me, but a lot of other people, it works better for them. And so if it works better for you, who cares if it doesn't work very well for me? That's you know, my loss and your gain. Mm-hmm. So I did try this. I got some work done last night. Was it last night? It doesn't matter. Got some work done on it for a little while. It is substantially better than the original version in terms of screen space, and therefore, like, the usability of that screen space. I found the ultra wide, the biggest setting, to actually be way too much space. I had to do so much head turning. I'm like, this is ridiculous. So I actually stuck with the middle setting, the wide. And I found that to be the most comfortable for me. And it was a decent amount of space. It was a little bit wider than the actual, what the hell is my expensive monitor called? The Pro Display. Yeah. So it's a little bit wider than the Pro Display XDR. I think in terms of like what it was simulating, I think not quite as tall maybe, but anyway, it doesn't matter. It was a lot of screen space, plenty of screen space on the middle setting for me, without too much head turning. So that part was fine. You know, the scale, the ability to use the space, that was all very good. The main problems I had with the original version were, number one, I could notice the foveated rendering, which is bad. Like, because that's like, you see kind of out of the corner of your eyes, like, which parts of the screen are blurry that you're not quite looking at. And maybe it was a little slow to update when you would move your eye to it. I did not notice that this time. So I don't know if they've actually improved that or if I've stopped noticing. I think they might have actually improved it. So you don't notice the foveated rendering blurriness on the stuff you're not looking at anymore. At least I didn't. I did still notice the two other major problems I had with it the first time, which are a lack of sharpness and latency. One of the first things I tried when I first got the Vision Pro, I tried editing a podcast in it with Logic. And the screen space was delightful, but the problem was there's a little bit of latency. And when you're like, if you're just typing in a document, you won't see it. But when you start moving stuff around, you do see it. You do feel that latency. And it feels really bad and really wrong. And it makes certain types of work very difficult to do in that environment without, like, driving yourself nuts. So latency is still there. I still notice it. And that alone would be enough for me to not really want to use this very, very often, if ever.
Now, quick interruption. Are you using this via Wi-Fi, or are you plugging in via the developer strap?
I was not plugged in by the laptop it was connected to was connected to Ethernet. But the Vision Pro was on Wi-Fi.
Gotcha.
That being
okay.
said, you know, the Wi-Fi router is like 10 feet away. Like,
it's not right, sure.
And nothing else ever says this is a bad Wi-Fi connection right here in my seat.
Yeah,
at
yeah,
the
yeah
desk.
Absolutely.
So anyway, and I would argue that, you know, I would argue that's the way to actually judge it anyway, is when using it on Wi-Fi, because that's how it's really made. Anyway, because the developer strap gives you a second cable down the other side of the Vision Pro. By the way, I actually did solve my Vision Pro standby issues. Quick aside here. I've decided when I'm not using the Vision Pro, I just disconnect the battery cable from it. Which is, you know, that's obviously like, it's like unplugging a desktop. It powers off immediately and it does not do a clean shutdown, but I don't care. And so when I disconnect the battery cable for storage, I did that last time I put it away. That was probably, 2 weeks ago? I got it out this time. Perfect charge. It booted up just fine. The battery still showed green. Like, everything was totally fine. So if you actually unplug it from its battery, it does last substantially longer in standby mode. Anyway, so going back to the screen, the Mac Virtual Display update. The latency is still a problem for me. The sharpness is still really poor. When you look directly at something and you kind of stabilize yourself, I'll get to that in a second, it is, you know, you can see what it is. It's not like the pixels are so blurred that you like can't read lettering or you can't see lines. Like, it's not that bad, but it is blurred. And when you look at the optical pipeline of what is being shown on a Vision Pro, it has to be blurred. We are nowhere near the optical resolution or screen resolution required to actually replicate the pixel density of a computer monitor at a regular distance inside the Vision Pro. We're nowhere near it. We are many generations away from that being realistically possible, if it ever comes. So it is substantially blurrier than looking at a real monitor. It has substantial latency. And then one of the big killers for me is the Vision Pro has significant motion blur when you move your head or eyes very much. And part of the, like, when you look at the design of Vision Pro native apps, everything is huge. The windows are huge. The buttons are huge. The text is pretty big. Everything about Vision Pro or Vision native apps, everything is big. And it's simulated to be somewhat far away from you, too. And so everything, like, you don't notice the motion blur as much. And then the best thing to do, in my opinion, with the Vision Pro is watch 3D video content or immersive content. And with that, you don't really see it at all because of, you know, the type of viewing you're doing in there. The small amount of motion blur when you move your head is kind of just blurred away and compensated for with everything else you're seeing. But when you're looking at, like, a computer screen, which has a very high pixel density, trying to make all these nice sharp windows and nice sharp text in this window, the motion blur of the Vision Pro, of just moving your own head, just even very slight movements as you operate your computer, you notice it constantly. At least I did. And so I found it very unpleasant to use. And I think, again, I think if this is the kind of thing that if you have already been using the Vision Pro Virtual Display Mode, like, before this update, and it was fine for you, then this is even better for you. So enjoy it. If you had the problems with it that I had of latency, blurriness, and motion blur, those are not improved. And I don't think it's possible to meaningfully improve them with the current hardware. So basically, if you already have a Vision Pro, this is a useful thing to try, and this might get you to use it more. If you don't already have a Vision Pro, this probably is not a good enough reason to go out and buy one.
I was with all of your summary until that very last line. So reiterate that for me, and maybe it's because my eyes are not great, and I know I've said this 1,000 times, but just one more time to set the stage. I have a weird eye disease called keratoconus. That means I wear hard contact lenses. It's actually been said on Apple's documentation that you shouldn't wear hard contact lenses with Vision Pro. It probably won't work. I've never had a problem with that.
Well, don't tell them.
My vision is actually pretty good with my contact lenses in. I'm like 20, 30 or something like that. I forget what I am, but it's actually not bad. But without my contacts, I'm even more blind than John, and that's saying something. So I think it is possible, it is certainly possible, if not probable, that maybe some visual wonkiness that is really a shortcoming of the Vision Pro is actually my own eyes. I don't know. This is the only eyes I've got, so I can't tell you one way or the other. But whatever the case may be it because of the Vision Pro, be it because of my eyes or whatever, I don't find it to be that off-putting. I don't really get the motion blur. Occasionally, I find it's a little difficult to focus, but it usually goes away very, very quickly. That might have to do with maybe my eyes settling down and the foveated rendering calming down. I'm not sure, but generally speaking, I find this works really well. And so this morning I had the occasion to go to a local library, and I needed to be there to return something, and I figured, well, I'll just gonna chill and work for a little bit. And so I am enough of that guy to use the Vision Pro at the library, but I'm not enough of that guy to do it in the middle of like all the other people working at the library. So I reserved a study room at one of the local libraries, and I sent this picture to Marco, and I forget exactly what you said, but you said something along the lines of, holy crap, could you not have found a bigger place to work, because it is effectively a closet. And that's true. But I sat myself in this little study room, and I put on my Vision Pro, and I looked like a damned fool, but thankfully I wasn't in the middle of everyone, and I was using the Vision Pro, and I was using Mac Virtual Display, and I agree that the ultra-wide, while incredibly novel, is generally speaking just too much, especially since like the menu bar runs the entire width of the display. You know, if you think about the way it is on my desktop, on my desktop at home, or my laptop desktop at home, I have 3 different displays, so they each get a menu bar, and I can use the dock on any of them, right? And it'll be centered, the dock will be centered at the bottom of each individual display, and the menu bar is repeated across, or well, effectively repeated across each of these 3 displays. On the ultra wide, it's just one freaking huge display that, like you said earlier, something like 90 or 120 degrees of your vision. So if you need to find the menu bar, you got to turn your head all the way to the left to go find it. And I don't mean to imply that it's a burden, but it's striking, right? I think the ultra wide is a bit too much, but the wide is incredible. And I got a lot of work done with this on. Now, granted, the comfort, I think I've actually, while I was sitting there, I ordered one of the $50 Belkin head strap things that I should have ordered a while ago, and apparently my local store doesn't have in stock, which was a bummer. I was literally going to drive home by the Apple store to grab one of them, but it was not in stock. So leaving the comfort behind or aside for a minute, it was so incredible to be able to have all of this real estate, and it's all right there. I'm in this little closet of a room, and I have effectively a Pro Display XDR, maybe not literally, but effectively a Pro Display XDR right in front of me. It was phenomenal. And not only that, but I could put the music app, like above the display. So I'm using the native Vision OS music app that's in 3D space above my ultra wide display, or excuse me, my wide display or whatever. It was so amazing. And it occurred to me over the last few years, what I really want to be able to do is kind of work wherever I want to work, right? So that
am I hearing your fan chain hitting itself over and over again?
You might be. The fan is on. I can turn it off. Hold on.
No, you're hearing my my radiator probably turning on here.
Oh, yeah.
I mute myself.
Click,
does it go away?
Click,
let's see.
Click. All right.
I'm stepping away 2 seconds. Hold on.
I didn't want it to be on Casey's track because he's saying all this great stuff, and I have to like.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not on his track. It's my radiator. So.
All right. Sorry, Casey.
No. I'm glad you interrupted. I turned mine off just
like,
to be safe.
It sounds like one of those wobbly fans where the chain is hitting the globe over and over again. You know.
I don't think it was
80s
me.
Baseboard radiators. They are expanding.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it was me, but I turned it off just to be safe. And you will never offend me for interrupting for that sort of
sorry.
Thing. No, that's fine. So just help me. Where was I? Oh, right. Okay. So if we think about it, I'm sorry. Hi, Future Marco.
Sorry.
I'm rebooting a little
bit here. Yeah.
So do whatever makes sense. So over the last few years, what I've really wanted to do, and this started especially during COVID, is I want to be able to work wherever I want to work, right? And leave aside the Vision Pro for a second. Just in general, I want to work wherever I want to work. And when I entered the pandemic, when we all entered the pandemic in 2020, if I'm not mistaken, I still had an iMac Pro and a very serviceable 13-inch MacBook Pro. And over time, I feel like we are answering more and more, or Apple is answering more and more questions. So I was thinking about this. Like, the first question is, can I take my computer with me? And that's a solved problem, right? If you want to take your computer with you, you can just get a laptop. That is not up for grabs. We've solved this problem for 30, 40 years now or something like that. Not a big deal. The second problem is, can I power it? And that isn't much of a problem, generally speaking. If you go to a library or something like that, typically you can plug into power. But even if you can't, you can always bring like a USB-C battery or something like that to give you another hour or two. There's plenty of ways that you can solve this problem. So neither of these are really new problems or really that terribly interesting. But where things got interesting, I think, was starting in around 2020 with Apple Silicon. And when Apple answered the question, can I get my work done on it? And that started in 2020 with Apple Silicon, because now the computer that is portable, that I can pick up and walk away with, is just as powerful, if not more powerful, than that iMac Pro that was sitting on my desk. And part of the reason why I returned to the full-time laptop lifestyle was because my MacBook Pro, my M1 Max MacBook Pro at the time, was considerably quicker than my iMac Pro. And my M3 Max MacBook Pro is considerably quicker than a lot of Apple desktops. And I don't have to really make any compromises. Like, it was such an incredibly freeing feeling. If you're still on Intel, it is such an incredibly freeing feeling to know that you can take this incredibly powerful computer and just walk away with it. You can just buy a laptop and walk away with it. And you don't need a MacBook Pro to do that. Like, as we've said many times, the MacBook Airs are also incredibly powerful computers.
Yes.
That you can easily walk away with. It's unreal. And then, so can I get my work done on it? Hell yeah, I can, because they are so darn powerful. And then the other thing, and this is where the Vision Pro comes in, is, do I have the space to get my work done on it? And I mean screen real estate. A 13-inch laptop is not a fun way to get work done unless you're doing very, very basic stuff. But typically in the last couple of years, and I've talked about this on the show, I bought a like 2K portable display, a bus-powered portable display. It is a piece of trash, but I love it because that gives me a second display that I can set next to my MacBook Pro. It's super thin, super light. It doesn't need a power supply. Like I said, it's bus powered. It's great. And that would get me enough that I could do development work in a pinch on the go. Wasn't fun, but I could do it. With the Vision Pro, I can legitimately do my development work, and it might be a little less convenient than having my full array of 3 5K displays, but not that much. The compromise, even with that spare physical 2K display, the compromise was still quite large. But now, if you can leave aside the fact that you look like a friggin' idiot, the compromise is really not that much at all. And in fact, for most people that don't have 15Ks sitting in front of them, it's actually arguably better in the ultra-wide display. Now, I agree with Marco. I think ultra-wide is actually too much, but that's neither here nor there. My point is just that I am now able to set up an entire workstation by way of a MacBook Pro and a Vision Pro. And I just think that is so incredibly cool. That is so cool that one of the things I can do, which I haven't done yet, but one of the things I could do is during the workday, if I feel like I'm just a little uncomfortable in my desk chair or what have you, I can go down to my couch. And I can sit on my couch with my nerd goggles on my head, and I can be doing work on my couch. There's nothing wrong with it. It's almost as good as on my desk. And I just think that is such an incredibly powerful, cool thing. And again, there's so many things I could say to poo-poo this. I'm talking about, what, $9,000 worth of hardware or something like that? It is an absolutely asinine amount of money that I'm talking about. I said earlier the laptop was like $5,000. The Vision Pro is $3,500 plus the $400 developer strap. We're now at like $9,000. That is bananas. But it is so incredibly cool to have that future, I was going to say in my hands, but also on my face today. And I think that's so incredibly powerful. But here's where I'm going to drag Marco back in.
Oh, no.
You know what else is missing? You know what the thing is that would really make this truly and incredibly and just perfectly portable? I can figure out power. I can figure out my display. But Marco, what do I not have yet? What is not internal to my MacBook Pro?
Internet.
I cannot imagine how cool it will be when Apple finally one day, when I'm 95 years old, decides to put a cellular modem in this MacBook Pro. Because then this literally could be used anywhere, anywhere there's civilization. You know, I'm sure there's an asterisk there, but you know what I'm saying? I could go to my beloved park bench / picnic table. I could go wherever the hell. I could be in the car in the passenger seat. I could be wherever. And I can have my MacBook Pro and my Vision Pro, and I can get work done damn near as well as I can do it on my desk. And whether or not you think that's a wise use of my money, whether or not you think it's a smart idea to put this nerd goggles on your face, it is so powerful. I would say empowering, but I think that might be a little dramatic. But it's powerful that I can get my work done in the same fidelity, for lack of a better word, as my desk. And I can do that almost anywhere. I can do it anywhere that I have internet. And that to me is so cool. And I still mostly agree with Marco that, I 100% agree with Marco that if this is something that didn't work for you before, like the Mac Virtual Display thing didn't work for you before, you're probably not going to like it now. I concur. It is better, as Marco had said, but it's not, you know, night and day better. But if you're like me, and this is something that worked before, but now you want to see what it's like now? Let me tell you. Oh, it's so good. It's so good. And this is the sort of thing that if you have the money to spend on this sort of thing and the desire to be able to work wherever, and maybe it's only that you travel a lot, you want to be able to work really efficiently in your hotel room or whatever the case may be. Suddenly this is becoming, and many other people have said this over the last few days, this is starting to become a killer feature for me. And I think that this will genuinely think that this will make me want to use my Vision Pro more. Not in the house necessarily. I still think all the problems we've talked about many times about not being enough content is still true in the house, but it's going to make me use it out of the house, especially on the occasions that I travel much, much more. And I cannot say enough good things about it.
If Apple really cared about this use case with the, you know, the M5 powered successor to the Vision Pro or whatever, they should just let you plug a Thunderbolt cable from the headset into your Mac to get rid of the latency thing that Marco was complaining about. Like, just fully embrace the idea of it as an external monitor. And yeah, it'll still have to do all the 3D and the tracking and the blah, 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 but the latency should be gone thanks to whatever clever thing they do over Thunderbolt to, you know, essentially rendering into a virtual display somewhere inside the Vision Pro that it then puts into 3D space in front of you without having to do any Wi-Fi or compression shenanigans or stuff like that. But I'm not sure Apple cares that much about this use case. I know, Casey, you love this use case, but I think Apple probably thinks the appropriate level of technological innovation and cost is what they're doing now. Pretty good resolution, very big display, wireless, convenient, no cables. You don't have to put all the extra hardware and memory inside the Vision Pro to support it and stuff like that. But yeah, like you can see how if the Vision Pro was emphasizing this use case much more and de-emphasizing many other ones, first of all, it would have to make the Vision Pro even more expensive just for the memory stuff, but you could do that. And if you want to go really expensive, you know, the Vision Pro with an M5 in it, you know what that could do? It could just freaking run Mac OS in addition to Vision OS. You know what I mean? Like with virtualization, but like you could just run your Mac. Like, why do you need to have this laptop that you bring with? What is the purpose of the laptop? It's just sitting there over in the corner, right? Again, that would make it even more expensive, heavier, hotter. You'd have to have an external compute thing. The battery would have to be bigger. But like, that's not the use case that Apple is going for. So I don't think they're going to do any of that. But technologically speaking, because Apple, like Taco Bell, is using all the same different ingredients to make lots of different things.
Slightly different results.
Yeah, but you look at the Vision Pro and you're like, you know, all the pieces are there. Like, if you could arrange these Lego pieces to make Vision Pro, like the Casey's dream, like on the go Mac development thing, all the pieces are there except for Apple's cell modem that's going to put cellular into Mac someday, which we'll have a story on in a future episode if we remember to do it. But we're still waiting for that day. It's a race between a worthy Mac Pro chip and cellular in Macs, and it looks like Casey might win this one.
Yeah, you never know. I'm glad actually you brought up the plugging it in via Thunderbolt thing, because I should say that my experience, I believe I've only exclusively used it with the developer strap with the thing plugged in. So that's another reason why Marco's experience might have been slightly worse than mine. And it does appear that by default, it will try to hop on Wi-Fi between the computer and the Vision Pro. But then I think it negotiates this via Bluetooth. But I definitely noticed once I plugged it in, and I think I actually killed Bluetooth on my Mac, if I recall correctly, it clearly renegotiated the connection over the cord, over the cable. And then I pulled it out because I realized, like a ding dong, I had taken the cable that's coming out my right ear and connected it to the left side of my computer. I don't know what I was thinking. So I unplugged it, moved it to the right side of my computer, and the screen immediately went black. And it, once I plugged it back in, it took a few seconds before it renegotiated, but it did come back on its own. But I think that certainly helped, like latency and stuff like that, some of the legitimate complaints that Marco had. But either way, it is so cool. And there's no easy way for Apple to demo this when they do like the Vision Pro demos or whatever, because it all is relying on like Apple, your Apple ID or whatever, it's Apple account now. And there, it would be a lot to get this to work. But oh man, if you have a friend where you could just strap their face computer on your face for a minute, it's worth trying because it is so freaking cool. All right. Hi, future Marco. I don't think we're going to do Ask ATP, right? Because we're running the...
Oh, yeah, 140. Yeah, all right, we'll end here. Okay, let me pull up sponsors.
Bye, future Marco.
All right, thank you to our sponsors this week, Tailscale, Delete Me, and Aura Frames. And thank you to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of ATP membership is ATP Overtime. This is our bonus topic every week. This week on Overtime, we're going to be talking about the story about there's a Mac emulator called Mini VMac that was being rejected by Apple's notarization, even from third-party app stores in the EU, which is quite a story. So we're going to be talking about the Mini VMac notarization rejection from the EU app stores. Interesting story. Anyway, you can hear our coverage of that in Overtime this week by joining atp.fm/join. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Before we get to Casey's thing on the after show, can I do a quick, this is not an ad, discussion of one of our sponsors this week?
Yes.
Yeah.
For the show, or for
legit,
the bootleg, or
not
what?
An ad. If you're listening to the non-member version, you by now probably have already heard the ad for Aura Frames. This is not the ad. This is just me talking about Aura Frames, which, yes, they did send us one of them for free. So take that with a grain of salt. I got mine for free. I have never bought a digital picture frame. Honestly, I thought they were like, why would anyone want that? It's just like a really low quality screen in your house. I have plenty of actual pictures up on the wall or whatever. So I, you know, whatever, they sent it to me, it's free. I guess I'll set it up to see what it's like. Love the thing. I don't understand why. Like, again, they're inexpensive. It's not a Pro Display XDR, right? It's not like, because, you know, it can't be. It's not thousands of dollars, right? It's an inexpensive, small color screen. Kind of like Casey's, like, 2K monitor thing that he loves, even though, like, it's not super high quality. I didn't, like, who would care that you have, like, I see my pictures, they're on my phone, they're on my Mac, like, why do I want to have a frame in my house that rotates through those pictures? Turns out, I do want to have that. I can't, like, it's so much enjoyment of looking at which picture it's showing right now. I pointed it at my favorites library, which has, like, 30,000 photos and something. It was like, no problem. I love the thing, like, oh, what was that picture? You just swipe on the top to go back to the previous one. I know this sounds like an ad. Honestly, like, this is like, you know, a gift. Like, I would not have bought this for myself. I would not have ever bought a digital frame, as evidenced by the fact that I've literally never bought one. I never bought one for someone else. I always thought they were dumb. Having been gifted this one essentially as part of a sponsorship made me realize I like digital picture frames. That's it. It's not an ad. I just wanted to say that I've discovered that I like digital picture frames.
Yeah, the Aura stuff is legitimately really, really good. And you will hear me, or some of you have heard me, do the sponsor read. But for real, and I'm now kind of regurgitating the sponsor read, but if you've had one of these in the past, this is not like that, because the ones in the past, you have to put an SD card in and it's just trash. And I'm not going to repeat the ad, but suffice to say, this is all that, but done right. It's really quite good.
I took like, 2 minutes to set it up ages ago and have not touched it since.
Yep. No, it's genuinely good stuff. All right, so I have a conundrum, and I'm probably making a mountain out of nothing, because, hi, have we met? But I am, I think, at the point that I'm ready to release the briefly previously mentioned, or I guess not so briefly, actually previously mentioned, update for call sheet, where you can have multiple lists of pins. So effectively, multiple batches of favorites, if you will.
Did you do the migration, the database migration we talked about last time?
Well, it's on the user side, right? I can't do that on my end.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
okay. Right. So
well, you can,
but,
you,
I mean,
so, and you, but you did the thing where you deployed it to production so the test flight would work.
Right.
So that's,
and
that
people
went
are using
fine,
it on,
I assume.
Yeah, yeah. And people are using it on test flight, and I haven't yet heard any issues as I knock furiously on wood. So I think I'm ready to release. But then it occurred to me, you know what? Apple has said to developers a handful of times recently, you know, you can tell us when you're going to be doing a new app or a new feature or whatever, and maybe you'll get a feature on the App Store. Maybe you'll get, you know, an editorial on the App Store. It'll be great. And I know full well that the likelihood of my little dinky app getting a feature on the App Store is not great. But I thought, what's it going to hurt to do what they ask you to do and report in and say, yeah, I've got this big new feature. It's the thing that almost all my users have asked for at some point or another. Why wouldn't I just tell them? And so I went down the path of telling Apple, hey, I'm going to be doing this probably in the next week or two. And completely fairly, especially given the time of year, very early on in Little Wizard, they have you go through to you know, get the information that they want. They say, hey, we really prefer for you to give us 3 weeks before your launch, which in and of itself is fine. But that means I'm not hitting my self-imposed deadline of before the end of the year. And my question to the two of you, and I think I'd like to start with Marco, if that's okay, is knowing that there's no real urgency to get this out other than a completely self-imposed deadline of wanting to be done with it before the end of the year, should I hold on till like the first full week of January? So like 2 or 3 weeks from where, I guess 3-ish weeks from where we are now, and give Apple the chance to feature me, even though I intellectually know that there's almost no chance of it happening. Like, what's it going to hurt to delay and try, or should I just get this out the door now? What do you think?
I have a question for you, Casey.
Oh, sorry. Yes.
We get opinions.
Please.
Is this, do you know if Apple, not insists, but if Apple wants you, won't feature you if you launch without them? Like, is the featuring contingent on you launching coordinated in time with their feature, or are those two separate things?
That is an excellent question, and I don't know the answer, but I think they want you to release as they feature. I do not know if that's accurate, though.
If only there's someone on the show who has experience with iOS.
Okay, so this is why I came to the show. So tell me, what am I doing? What should I be doing? What am I doing wrong? What should I be doing? Help me.
Okay, so first of all, I'll answer the second question first. The they want you to coordinate your other marketing with them. They don't want to be the only place promoting an app. They want
other marketing.
They want to jump on a bandwagon, and they want you to be doing a big push, and they want to be a part of the big push. That's not always the case. That's not the only way they'll promote something, but that's why they want to like coordinate with your release.
Casey, you should email ATP and tell them you have a new app there. Maybe you should offer the CEO of your company to be a guest on our show.
Yes, I should do that. God. Yeah. Oh God. That's such an inside joke, but yes.
Anyway. Yeah. We get a lot of PR email. Anyway. That being said, when you are trying to coordinate something like that, like by submitting it to them and like in advance with the number of weeks of notice and everything, that's kind of what you're going for. That is not guaranteed to actually happen.
Sure.
What also happens is if they see another app that like, hey, the blogs are posting about this app, like, you know, hey, this thing got reviewed on Mac Stories and 9to5 and everything. If they see that, the App Store editorial team, like they have people who like look for that kind of stuff. If they see that, they will come to you and send you a message in App Store Connect saying there's a promotional opportunity if you just submit artwork of these specs by this date. And what that means is we might feature you in the App Store and, you know, somewhere. Now, so that's the other part of this. If you actually succeed in being featured, that's what they will go to you with. They'll go to you with a promo art request. And so they'll say, all right, they'll link to some document somewhere on Apple's site that says, we're currently looking for this type of promo. And it'll say in the request, like a home screen header or whatever. There's different names for like the different positions in the App Store, different formats and everything. And they'll send you there's a link to like a Photoshop template. And it's like, okay, you have to have design your artwork within these safe guides and have it, feature these things, but not these things. And don't include screenshots. Don't include words. It'll go through all these requirements with you. So then that's then placed on you. And they'll say, give us the promo artwork by, so-and-so date. Usually give you a week or something, if you're lucky. Sometimes it's like 48 hours. Anyway, and so as developers, we are given that chance, and we say, we can either rush to put this promo art together ourselves, if we even can, and if it will look any good, or we can hire a designer or, tell, because they basically assume you have a designer ready to go. they assume you either are a designer or have one on staff, because they assume everyone's a big company. So as an indie, though, then you're stuck with, all right, I have to, find a designer and pay them to do this for me. And then you have to start weighing, what is this going to be worth it? Or should I try to do it myself, do my own custom promo artwork, but I'm a programmer, not a designer, and it'll look like crap. and the worse it looks, the less likely they are to actually use it and actually feature your app. Because when you submit that promo artwork to them, they basically say, thanks, we might feature you. That's it. You're kind of, throwing it into a black hole and hoping someday they maybe use it. They won't tell you where they're featuring you. They won't tell you when they're featuring you. They won't tell you if they choose to or not to. You just kind of have to watch for it. Although I think they've recently added a notification that if they do feature you, now it finally tells you. That was 2 weeks ago, very recent. Anyway, so all this is to say, the process of being featured in the App Store requires something of you. It requires you to... if you're going to go through what you were asking about notifying them ahead of time, that's one level. If it's going to be you having to make promo artwork, which is usually required, that's a different level. And so there is a certain amount of work and cost that is going to be put on you. And so the question of whether all this is worth it or not is worth asking. Sometimes it is. I think usually for indies who already have marketing channels, usually I think it's not worth it to bend over backwards. Now, if you can address what they're asking for without too much sweat off your back, without too much work, without too much cost, then sure, do it. You might as well do it if it's going to be easy. But if what they're asking for is going to cost you thousands of dollars in designer time or heck, even hundreds, it probably won't be worth it. Because the thing is, an App Store feature used to be worth a lot more than it's worth now. Because not a lot of people, it seems, are just casually browsing the App Store, looking around for new apps to install. It used to be that way. When iOS was younger and less mature and less established, when people were actually... getting their first iOS devices still, there was a lot of just browsing around that happened. I remember back in my Instapaper days, Christmas Day used to be a huge sales day for me. It was one of my biggest sales days of the year, because so many people, Instapaper had pretty good business on the iPad, and so many people would get iPads for Christmas, and that was often their first iOS device, or at least their first iPad. And so they would then immediately go browsing around, hey, what can I do on this thing? Let me install a bunch of apps. Now, most people with iOS devices, this is not their first iOS device. So how many new apps they need to browse around and install, it goes down over time. And now there's so much out there. There's so many apps that I don't think a lot of people are just kind of browsing the editorial sections of the iOS App Store. So the value of it, I occasionally do get featured, which is very nice. I'm very thankful for it. But I see, when you look at the sales that happen as a result of that, it's hard to see a bump anymore. I'm sure it helps. I'm sure, any bit helps. And if you don't already have a ton of exposure in any other way, you got to take whatever you can get. But the effect that it has gone down over time to the point where now I think it's more of a vanity and honor thing than an actual thing that translates to sales. And so you should account for that in deciding how much to either spend accommodating their plans and or how much to change your plans in response to that. So my advice after all of that elaboration would be, don't change your plans. Release it when you want to release it, and if they want to feature it, they'll come to you.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm wrestling with is, what's it going to hurt to wait and see? Like, what's it going to hurt to throw this over the wall, give myself the remainder of the year to breathe, and perhaps, you know, just make sure everything is good to go? And yeah, I have, I guess, failed in that I haven't released the thing that I've been working on, but it's done. Like, it's ready. It's released in test flight. And the only person that's really going to be disappointed in it not being out is me. And I don't feel like that's enough of a reason to rush it, right? And especially if, you know, God forbid, the rollout ends up being a disaster.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, what does it hurt? I would want to get it out and make sure it actually works before I get featured. The worst thing you want to have happen is get featured just as you launch and there's some fatal bug that causes problems with your app, and now you've, like, drawn lots of attention to your mistake. Like, that's why I want to get it out. And for the wisdom of releasing it just before the holidays aside, I would want to have my be sure the app that was going to be featured was stable and working.
Which is fair, but if I'm also coordinating the big release with Apple, I can't have both, right?
Well, unless that's why I was asking, something. Do they care if you coordinate the release or do they just want to feature you? Because if they don't care if you coordinate the release, I would want to have my new version out for 3 weeks, you know, maybe get a one or two bug fix updates out and then get featured if they don't insist that you not release your app until, and Marco's thing about they want to be coordinating with your marketing push. If you don't have a marketing push, I wonder how they'll feel about that. Like, you are the marketing push, Apple.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't know. I got a noodle on it. And certainly if App Store Editorial wants to quietly whisper in my ear, not necessarily whether or not I'd be featured, but just, you know, what is the expectation?
They'll never tell you that. Trust me. Ask any iOS developer, you know, ask Underscore, like ask Ben McCarthy, ask everyone you know who has apps in the store. They're all going to tell you the same thing.
Which is
submitted PR artwork for some of my apps at one point. And they did actually, if not write about them, then at least like list them somewhere at some point in the past. But no, they did not tell me when they were doing this. I found out because other people told me, hey, I saw your app on this thing. I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah, and they did recently launch like notifications for when you're featured where. And you can also, like, I've been notified through App Figures. Like, they have a thing. If you use App Figures, they'll tell you. But it is mostly just like you kind of just rely on people telling you on social networks, hey, congrats, I saw your app in this thing. And again, like, it's nice, but it's really hard to see much of a bump from those anymore just because I think the number of people who are just casually browsing looking for new apps to install I think that number is very small these days. The reality is, because as I was saying earlier, because the iOS market is so full and so cutthroat and so dramatically overserved with just huge amounts of apps all the time, you usually have to pay to get people to install your app. Like, you have to buy search ads, you have to buy Facebook sure. ads, whatever, like that, like that, and paying for app installs is not cheap. Because there's so much competition from everyone else trying to get people to install their apps. So the bids all get bid up. So, like, it's really hard to get installs of your app because no one is going out there and just looking organically unless they hear about it from your other marketing channels, from your podcast, from your blog. Like, that's where to promote your app. And just talking about it on here is worth way more than most types of App Store features that any of us would be likely to actually get. Now, if you happen to be like the app of the day on the front page of the App Store, then you're talking about different numbers. That is more substantial, and that is worth it, of course, if you can get it. But this kind of smaller feature is like, oh, top apps to be cozy this winter or whatever, like kind of stuff, you're not going to see much from that. It is a nice honor. Again, like, it's an honor to be featured, and it's nice to have your work recognized by Apple, and it feels good. But in terms of translating to actual, like, really meaningful sales and downloads, it's not much. So your plans are more important. So launch your app when you want to launch your app, And you can tell them afterwards, like once it's launched and once it's settled, you can email that address and say, hey, I got this new update out and it's being well received. And here's, you know, positive reviews or whatever. You can tell them afterwards, but don't change your plans for them because, first of all, they wouldn't do it for you. And second of all, it's probably you're better off serving your customers directly in the best way you see fit, not bending over backwards trying to accommodate something that you might get from Apple that probably wouldn't have a ton of value.
Yeah. All right, well, I appreciate the conversation. I'll noodle on it and see what I decide to do. Yeah, I don't know. I got to think on it, but this is very helpful and I appreciate it. All right, let's do some titles. A good, careful programmer isn't bad. Incredibly dangerous app is pretty good. I wrote a Perl script is good. There's a lot of good ones.
I like whatever.photo library.
That was a good one I heard before that I hope would be in here, and I gotta find it now. Let's see.
Everyone likes free disk space.
Yeah, and incredibly dangerous. Oh! That was a good one.
Can you call it free lunch?
I would guess there's an app with that name out there already, and I don't want to deal with all the no such thing as jokes. So,
it yeah. might be untrademarkable, though, which could work in your favor.
Free real estate.
I like free lunch. That's a good Let's see.
I might have to give up on probably what will happen is I'll have to give up on the whole make it look like a thing that make it sound like a thing that works on discs and just pick a name that means nothing. That
like free
me.
Lunch.
Because that's, you know.
The problem, or boxed lunch.
The problem is, yeah, but the problem is if it's free lunch, it makes it hard for you to charge money for the product.
It's free to download.
Well, yeah. Honestly, I do like having free in the name for like App Store SEO. I mean, honestly, look, if you're in the Mac App Store, no one else is there, so you'll be
there's
fine.
No, there's no such thing as SEO.
That's the problem. Like, when you're on the Mac App Store, like none of this wisdom from iOS applies to the Mac App Store at all because it's
but
just a
there
ghost
is
town.
Some kind of keyword thing though, because every time I search for stuff, I see essentially the keyword squatters who are like somehow getting themselves put into results when they shouldn't be because they're, you know, using competitive keywords or whatever to, you know.
Yeah, but there's just, I mean, the Mac App Store, like this, I mean, part of the reason why it actually is a decent idea to get into the Mac App Store if you're doing something like this is because the Mac App Store is desperate for things to feature. And so if you make a Mac app that is just
my dinky apps have ever been listed anywhere because there's not much going on, you know? Yeah. It's like, well, it's an app that was introduced.
Yes. Like, if you make something that's reasonably just decent and you put it in the Mac App Store,
They need new apps. They need there to be, like, and iOS is not a problem. There's 1,000 new apps every second, right? But they need apps that did not exist before that exist now. Yeah, I think Incredibly Dangerous App is my favorite. Whatever I was looking for before, I couldn't find.
An Incredibly Dangerous App. I like that. I do like Everyone Likes Free Disk Space better, but I'm fine with that one also.
I think I prefer Incredibly Dangerous App. I do think I feel like Casey now.
Maybe that's the name.
Like the Incredible Machine.
Yeah.
All right, let me put that in the robot. Hold on.
Danger's my middle name.
All right, Austin Powers.
Wow.
Wait, what was our pre-show?
It's the middle name of the app. See, it's right in the middle.
Anyway. Pre-show is Socks.
Oh, yeah.
Holy
we
Socks.
We have that covered.
Laundry Tactics. Shoot, except I have the wrong sponsors. All right, we're just going to vamp for a minute. I almost said vape, and that's not at all.
We're not going to do that.
Nope.
I mean, you guys can, but that's not my seat.
Nope. Nope, nope, nope.
All right. Thank you, live people, for listening. We're going to cut you off now and go to overtime for the bootleg. Thank you very much. When do we record next? Let me double check here. I believe we're on next Wednesday. Usual?
I think Miracle of Miracles, that is correct.
It is indeed a Wednesday before it gets weird again around Christmas.
Yep. All right. So, yeah, next week we are on regular Wednesday schedule. So, thank you, live people. We'll see you then.